It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. Two people in studio. Harry McCracken, the technologizer, is here. Kathy Gellis from Tech Dirt is here. Also, Amanda Silberling joins us for the first time ever from TechCrunch. We will talk about the three big Supreme Court decisions that came down this week. Turns out Kathy wrote amicus briefs for two of them. She says it's one win, one loss. We'll find out what that means. We'll also talk about the change in streaming TV and the failure of pay TV services. And a whole lot more. It's all coming up next. We might even play a little D&D next on Twit.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit. This Week in Tech, episode 928, recorded Sunday, May 21st, 2023. SCOTUS didn't read my briefs. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Grammarly Go. You'll be amazed at what you can do with Grammarly Go. Go to grammarly.com/go to download and learn more about Grammarly Go. And by Noom. Stop chasing health trends and build sustainable, healthy habits with Noom's psychology-based approach. Check out Noom's first-ever book, The Noom Mindset, a deep dive into the psychology of behavior change, available to buy now wherever books are sold. And don't forget to sign up for your trial at noom.com/twit. And by Duo. Duo protects against breaches with a leading access management suite, providing strong, multi-layered defenses to only allow legitimate users in. For any organization concerned about being breached that needs a solution fast, Duo quickly enables strong security and improves user productivity. Visit signup.duo.com today for a free trial. And by Mint Mobile. Inflation is everywhere, whether it's gas, utilities, or your favorite streaming services. Thankfully, Mint Mobile can give you a much-needed break. Get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month and get the plan shipped to your door for free when you go to mintmobile.com/twit. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news. I'm a little scared. I have people in the studio today. This is scary. Harry McCracken, hello. Good to see you.
Hey, Leon.
Fast Company, the technologizer. Your name, you might have heard your ears burning earlier this week because people were saying, well, no one uses an iPad for day-to-day work. And I said, well, Harry does.
Absolutely. I have for like 12 years.
11-inch pros now. And you're feeling pretty good because now you got Final Cut and Logic on there. So
I will soon, or in Final Cut at least, is exciting.
You're ready. Also in studio with us from Tech Dirt, our favorite intellectual person. She's an attorney, Kathy Gellis.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, Kathy. CGCounsel.com. You're on Mastodon at Kathy Gellis. But more importantly, Kathy wrote not one but two amicus briefs for big Supreme Court decisions that came down this week. And we were going to talk about both of them. One had a lot to do with fair use. The other, turns out, didn't have anything to do with Section 230. It could have, though.
It could have. It will reverberate in the same space.
It will reverberate in the same space. Wow. Okay, I'm going to think about that for a little while I introduce Amanda Silberling, who I've been wanting to get on this show forever and ever. She writes about culture. She's the senior culture writer at TechCrunch. And it's great to see you. You've been on Tech News Weekly before, but we never got you on this show. So welcome.
Yeah, it's exciting to be on the show.
I don't want to say anything, but it looks like somebody stole your guitar.
Man, I should have that in the background because it's like a neon pink bass and it makes me look really cool. But it's in the other room right now because I had a bass lesson the other day.
Because you were playing it. That's a good reason.
Yeah.
Excellent.
So it's in the other room inside of a black case, but it should be there looking cool.
Pink.
I'm pointing the wrong way.
So before we get to the Supreme Court, because I do want to get to the Supreme Court, but I also... Amanda had a scoop that I thought was really interesting. I kind of want to mention this. It looks like you saw an email or from Instagram that Instagram is going to launch a Twitter clone.
See, I love that you think it's a scoop because I think Leah Haberman and Matt Navarra posted this before me. So thank you for giving me the credit. But tell my editors that it was a scoop.
Leah tweeted it. Yeah, but that doesn't count. You wrote the article. That's what matters.
Yeah. I mean, also, actually, before we got on, apparently, the incoming CEO of Twitter, Linda Yaccino, she just retweeted the TechCrunch tweet of that article. So thank you for the traffic, Linda.
That's interesting. I wonder why the new CEO of Twitter would be promoting a major competitor from Meta.
Well, she said, I think she said like game on or something was her comment.
It's like the welcome. Right, seriously. Like
Instagram is validating the market by entering it.
Yeah.
I think our belief in rational behavior by anybody running the company that is Twitter these days might be overestimating.
I wonder what Elon will say. So Instagram is, and this is the slide, I guess, that Leah Haberman got. Instagram is going to launch up. It looks a lot like Twitter. It's text-based, right? Not photo-based. It says, quickly build your audience in one tap. Anyone can follow the accounts they follow on Instagram. So it's kind of just Instagram comments in a kind of a separate space, yes? That's what it feels like a little bit.
Yeah, it seems like it's going to be very similar to Twitter, but basically, if you have an Instagram account, then you can just carry over your handle and your verification status if you're verified. And then it'll give a little notification like, Amanda is now on whatever they name the Twitter clone. But yeah, I mean, this is all very speculative. Instagram wouldn't give me a comment on the record about it. But there was another blog. It's in the article, but I'm forgetting the name now. But they did give them a comment, and they were like, this is in development, essentially. But it is interesting that they're being hush-hush. However, I did see an email that they sent to a creator where they're basically trying to get, like, big-name creators, actors, athletes to just get on the platform from the get-go, because that's kind of
that's what drives
growth. Yeah. If people are like, oh, man, LeBron is over here. Sure.
That's totally what made Blue Sky kind of explode, was suddenly some big names like AOC.
She follows me, which,
wow,
it's an honor. She's never engaged with any of my Blue Sky skeets. That's what they're called officially. But she does follow me on there. And it's an honor and a privilege that I am. I'm afraid she's going to unfollow me and then I'm going to feel bad.
So just say nothing. Say nothing. So the new the blog you were talking about is Money Control, rather.
Yes.
And they say it's going to be called either, it's codenamed P92 or Barcelona, neither of which will be the name, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Meta said in a statement to Money Control, we're exploring a standalone decentralized social network for sharing text updates. We believe there's an opportunity for a separate space where creators and public figures can share timely updates about their interests. Yeah, we call it Twitter. We believe there is an opportunity and has been. It's interesting, though, they say decentralized, because you don't think of Instagram as decentralized in any way.
Nope.
article says it will, well, actually, this is from the slide, it will be compatible with other apps like Mastodon. That doesn't mean we'll be on the Fediverse necessarily. I don't know what that means.
Yeah, it's really confusing wording because, like we were talking about this before we went live, that it's just confusing because you would think that if it's compatible with Mastodon, then it would be built on ActivityPub. But maybe it's not. Maybe, like, are we going to have, like, Amanda@Instagram.com? Is that how it's going to be interoperable? It's like the tech behind it feels very vague, but I guess
there's some,
I think it'd be cool if it's decentralized.
Yeah.
There's some like little bits of, I when I saw this get tweeted and social media, I saw a lot of cynicism behind it. But as we're talking about it, I actually think there's some little sparks of a good idea here, but it really feels like not enough meetings have actually happened in the company to work this all out, because I think it's actually really interesting if Instagram has something that is their own community that they foster and they moderate and somehow monetize, but that they're using a technology that's less proprietary. Like, that's really interesting, but that is a fundamental shift in the way that a Facebook property has operated. So it could be a really big idea, but that's got to kind of happen from C-level suite type things, because it fundamentally re-architects the company.
Well, we don't know where this slide is from, and it may be that the people who are doing it know more than the people who made this silly slide. But I completely agree with you. I think the opportunity is very interesting. If anybody were open to new ideas at this point, it would be Meta, right? Because their bet on the metaverse has not been... hit.
I think individual employees at Meta are very bright. No, I'm not. I mean, the mind that thought that was a good idea makes me wonder.
But he's chastened now. Is he not? Isn't Mark saying, oh, whoops, I should have done AI?
I think.
A mistake.
I don't think they're like walking it back, but I think in the investor calls, like with so many companies right now, it's like, everyone just wants to say AI as much as possible when they are reporting their earnings, because they're trying to make the investors happy. But I think I wrote this at some point, who knows where it is, on techcrunch.com somewhere. But like at the last quarterly earnings report, Mark was like, we're not backing away from the metaverse. We're just also focusing on AI. But
What's your sense of that, Harry?
Well,
I know you've written a lot about this.
They're not abandoning the metaverse. Like, abandoning the metaverse would involve things like shutting down MetaQuest and so forth, which I do not expect to happen. It must be less of a priority, particularly when they have fewer people on staff and are trying to be efficient.
Right.
I think
they fired, 25,000 or something?
It seems like it would be a terrible mistake to downplay AI in order to put all your resources into the metaverse. And in fact, Meta actually does have a lot of great AI people who have done...
Jan LeCun.
They have done a lot of great research, and the next step is to actually figure out how to make that into a better and more successful Meta, which has not quite happened yet, but could, so...
And they're not mutually exclusive, right? You could have VR with AI. Then you have Vry.
I mean, I think what people kind of feel... But people feel it's not
French for true, I might point out. So it's not a bad slogan and not a bad nickname. You can use it if you want. Go ahead.
I think
that's
what people
too clever
feel is
for them.
I think what maybe almost everybody agrees, whether they've acknowledged or not, is that the metaverse is not like 2 years away, because the hardware we really want for the metaverse is not 2 years away. And in fact, there are just some fundamental things about creating great metaverse hardware that we don't know how to do yet.
I foolishly spent
$1,600
on the Oculus Pro, which is now $1,000 very shortly thereafter. and it's not $1,600 worth of anything. It's not much better than the HTC Vive or even the original Oculus Rift, which I bought through a Kickstarter sale. Apple is now 2 weeks away.
2 weeks away, $3,000.
Less than that, a week from... No, 2 weeks away. Do we know that, though? I mean, my concern with Apple launching a VR headset is that maybe this is a category that's already dead. Is that a possibility?
Yeah. I never thought it was worth spending any attention on. Like, I've just kind of sat out this whole... I mean, I remember Vermal. Like, I've been in tech long enough that I've seen this before, and I've seen the same level of enthusiasm, and I've seen the same detachment of understanding what the technology could possibly solve as an identified problem.
By the way, everything you just said, if you took out VR and put AI in instead.
Exactly. I'm kind of sitting this one out, too.
Sentence.
I mean, you talked about Zuck chastened, but... I mean, he might say whoops, but if you don't have any sort of reckoning about what your error was and how you ended up coming to make it, he's just going to repeat them. And
when you put $25 billion into something, it's hard to say whoops.
Or $44 billion.
Is it even more?
He's been out-wasted money. I mean, so Zuck kind of he's kind of out of the limelight. He only wasted $25 billion. Other people have wasted a lot more.
We don't know, because Apple's very secretive how much they might have spent on this. Your headline last month, Harry, was how Apple's headset could be a $3,000 flop and a success.
Yeah, I mean, I thought way, way back to... the early 1980s, when Apple released the Lisa, which was a $10,000 computer.
Very expensive
flop.
Which
only lasted for a few years and is remembered as a flop. but it was also a milestone along the way to the Mac. And even the Mac, when it came out, did not sell anywhere near as well as they expected. But on the other hand, the Mac is still around and is an enormous business. And I feel like we need to give the Lisa a little bit of credit for helping to jumpstart that process.
That's a really good point.
And therefore,
and more recently, you could even say the Apple Watch in its first few iterations was not a compelling product.
It took a while. Even the iPhone, if you look at the earliest coverage of the iPhone after it came out, people were not entirely sure whether the iPhone, as innovative as it was going to be a success.
Very
so
interesting.
I think it's quite possible it'll just take years before we know whether this Apple headset was worth
but
it or not.
That may be an important thing. You can have sleeper hits. And the problem is in our culture, we don't have good ways of appreciating and measuring sleeper hits. But you can have things like, I'm thinking the movie Clue, which came out in the theaters and
it's
failed.
Still sleeping, as far as I can tell. Is it
the
hit now?
The movie Clue, people love it.
Oh, really?
People watch it because they had split the endings, and that just ended up a mess. But they glued the endings together.
They watch it because it's bad.
No, Clue is good.
Oh, it's good.
Yes,
okay.
It's got some fantastic performances in it. I highly recommend
it. I'm going to watch it tonight. Yeah. I had no idea.
It turned into a play, I think.
It has legs, but it failed at the box office, but it was a quality product. So I think there's certain things where they come and they end up making a difference. And sometimes they come, they make a difference, but they die, but something about their legacy lives on.
Like the Lisa.
But sometimes the thing actually comes out and holds on, and it doesn't quite hit the... You're not going to measure it as a success because it's not an astronomical success, but it can hold on just enough that it can live on for years
and this
decades.
Is critical. Amy Webb said this last week on the show. Magic Leap had a vision for something that would take a decade to bring to fruition.
Ahead of their time is a phrase that we use.
But the venture the model of venture capital that they were using would never give them that much time, so they couldn't make it happen. Apple, on the other hand, is a almost $3 trillion company with billions in the bank, many billions in the bank, probably could, if it took a decade, if they were really committed, could make something of this. I guess my next question, though, is what makes this a success? I don't want whatever it is, this, even if it were $1,500, I already have one. What would it take for Apple's headset to be a success? Amanda, do you ever do VR gaming?
Yeah, I have a Quest 2 because Meta was just like trying to like get them into journalists' hands at the time, which is it is ethical because you need to have one in order to report
on
it.
You can't review anything without it. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. So great news for Mark Zuckerberg. If Mark is out there, hey, what's up?
Hey,
but
so-
I play rec softball, and today I overheard people while I was like running onto the field, and as I'm like running, I heard someone talking about their Oculus, and I was like, what? And then I was like, no, don't talk to them. You are playing softball right now. You're not at work. I have one, but
you don't spend a lot of time in it, I'm guessing.
I know. I mean, I did for a little
bit
because
it's one of those.
When I initially got it, like, I like to do physical activity in places that are not my apartment. But in case you forgot, there was a major international event that made doing things outside of your apartment temporarily less possible. And the Supernatural app, which the Meta acquisition
that's
of Within, which makes
yeah.
Supernatural, which right. is like an exercise app, that, I mean, that was a whole legal situation, but eventually the acquisition got closed. But yeah, Supernatural was like great, and I really enjoyed
Why'd
using
you
it.
Stop?
I thought it was really fun.
Why'd you stop?
But, I stopped because then the yoga studio near me opened.
Mm.
So I was like, cool, I'm going to go to yoga
go
now
instead.
And like not be looking at a screen, because I think that's like one of my big problems with it is after work, I don't want to be looking at screens.
Ah,
and there's a really big
like
difference
that.
Between like playing your Switch or having a thing on your head.
Yeah, I agree.
But I don't know. I mean, my whole take on all this, which this is like not a particularly intellectual take. I think this is incredibly obvious, but the idea of playing a video game in VR is really cool. The idea of taking a work meeting in VR is not. And all of the marketing around how you use these headsets has been really focused on like going to work and like doing meetings in VR. And I just don't really think we need to be in a VR meeting. Like,
you just told us why, though.
It's fine.
You just told us why, because you don't want to, you've been looking at screens all day. You don't want to use it after work. So Meta probably observed that and said, well, we'll use it for work. But nobody wants to use it for work either.
Why is this better than anything
else? It's not better. That's the problem.
Like, I mean, to some extent, we're talking computer-mediated communication. But that could mean anything. Like, right now, we're having computer-mediated communication, and this is fine. I don't need to have a headset and some 3D graphic rendering of a physical environment. I mean, even if we're not actually in the physical environment, that doesn't help me. It doesn't enhance the experience. I need to be able to hear you, maybe be able to see facial recognition, and just have a conversation and have the connection. And I don't see why adding this third dimensional immersive thing, even if it was rendered well, helps. Like, why that's the thing that we're just all desperate for. Because we can kind of connect via computers, via flatter technology.
And let's not forget that a certain percentage of the population, around 11%, gets nauseated by
wearing. I think I would be in the, I haven't tried it.
And so that's another reason to take it off after a little bit.
Yeah, I have a crush too, but I can't get it over my head and over my glasses.
Yeah, we wear glasses. So, Harry, assuming that this is the Lisa, when will it and what will it look like when it becomes a success?
Well, at $3,000, I assume that Apple is not expecting this to be like an enormous consumer product. Yeah. I mean, it might be something that enough people buy that they learn.
First, they talked about selling a million, which would be a $3 billion market. Now they're saying half a million. Still a big market.
So it seems like the price has to come way, way down. And there's certainly a lot of reporting they're working on cheaper versions.
I think they couldn't make it cheaper. I think that's the problem.
It also seems like, smartphones got more economical once the necessary technologies scaled up.
Even in the first year, the iPhone's price was cut significantly.
Right. So that could happen. Probably the one thing we will learn when they have this WWDC keynote is whether they have a better vision than Mark Zuckerberg or anybody else for killer apps that do indeed feel like they could be killer apps, because other than Supernatural, this whole world is very short on those things. And if nothing else, Apple is good at kind of figuring out how to not just put technology out in the world, but kind of figure out the stack of hardware and software and services that adds up to something compelling. And, are we going to be blown away by it in the way that people were blown away by the iPhone on day one? That seems unlikely, but it's at least conceivable that some of the ideas out there will have more clarity after Apple shows them off.
I think Apple's getting a pass from a lot of us because they have in the past done that. I'm not convinced that's going to happen this time.
It's really tough. I mean, I think the bar is higher than it was for the iPhone or the Apple Watch in a lot of ways.
I mean, I think Apple's got the money that it can spend it, including on some things that don't work. And quite frankly, that's the point of if you've got all that cash, that's kind of what you should do. I mean, you don't want to be completely reckless, but on the other hand, they can afford to take chances and make longer term investments. So more power to them.
Right.
Although if we're going to talk money for things, and even like smartphones coming down, I don't understand $1,800 for a foldable pixel. Like, I mean, maybe that's the cost of production, but I don't understand, because even the Samsung can flip and it's expensive at $1,000. Like, finally, there's a pixel that's foldable and it folds on the axis that doesn't actually fit in your pocket. But that's unreachable. And who wants to carry around that much cash value in your pocket?
And it has the equivalent of three very large screens, because it has a normal large screen and then something double the size of a large screen.
Yeah, the cheaper Samsung is a flip. So it's a regular size phone when you open it up. This is more like the Samsung Fold. It's the same price as a Samsung Fold,
Is it? Oh,
yeah, okay. So I think I'm sure Google looked at Samsung and said, well, how much can we charge? Oh, $1,700, okay. But I don't think anybody's going to buy it. I don't know why Google's releasing that. That doesn't make any sense.
I mean, they needed to produce something that flipped. I'm waiting for something that...
A flip phone's much better.
Yeah. Like something, because they got bigger and bigger and bigger, and I was waiting for it to shrink. Smaller. And the really good way to shrink it is fold it in half. And I'm looking at this. I'm like, oh, they have a foldable phone. I look at it. I'm like, you're folding it on the wrong axis.
You want the Galaxy Flip, which I think rumor has it Samsung will announce the Flip 4, is it, next in a couple of months, this summer. I guess it's the 5 because the 4 is out. This is what you want. It's cute. See? It folds in half. It's the size of a pocket square.
Yeah.
It folds the right way.
I covet it. I would rather have Pixel for various reasons, and I still don't want to spend $1,000 on my cell phone.
Yeah.
Like, I thought $1,000 was usurious, and the only thing that'll happen is new generations will drive down the price of the old ones, but I also don't want an outdated phone because, like, some of the other considerations are, like, the security of the phones, and you kind of want something that's, you know,
you must
newer.
You must be a con head.
A con
head. You know what I'm talking about? The TV show Succession.
I haven't seen it.
Conor Roy says running for president.
I've only seen one season.
Well, all you need to know is Conor Roy, who had an interest in politics at a very young age, is running for president. His slogan is, he's fighting against usury and onanism. So he's at least 50% in your pocket. Anyway, I'm sorry.
I'm bringing up 1980s movies as my cultural reference.
Yeah, you brought up Clue. At least I have a more modern show. All right. Moving along. Actually, Amanda, what is the time frame for Instagram's Twitter clone?
They said that they're aiming for release this summer, so we'll see. But that'll be really interesting to keep an eye on, and I will definitely be writing about it if that actually comes out this summer.
You may think I would be against it because I'm not a fan of centralized networks, but if it does in fact support ActivityPub or the Fediverse, I think that's kind of the kind of thing that would be very helpful for Mastodon and other Fediverse applications. If Firefox is doing a Mastodon, they haven't yet released it, but they plan to. I think this is good.
If they did a Microsoft, old school Microsoft of embrace and extend,
well, that would
we've
be
got
bad.
Problems.
No,
but given the little bit of details we have now, I think there's a surprising amount of potential to actually produce something good and useful for the ecosystem. But I will be maybe surprised if they do manage to produce something good and healthy for the ecosystem and not accidentally screw everything up for themselves or anybody else.
Well, there we have it, ladies and gentlemen. VR headsets, AI, and Twitter, all in one segment. This is a first. We got it all out of the way. The Supreme Court
Fastest
is coming.
Fastest show ever.
Yeah, we're done. Good night, everybody.
If anyone has a bingo card out there.
Yeah, we covered it all in one segment. We are going to talk more about the Supreme Court decision. There's a lot more to talk about in just a bit. I really like having all three of you here, though. This is great. Thank you, Amanda, for being on the show for the first time ever. Wonderful to have you. Thanks for having
me on a little screen, which makes me feel like a cyborg, but kind of in a cool way.
Well, to be fair, you have the biggest head on the set right now, so that's okay.
Yeah.
That's okay. You win.
I think she does. Just keep paying her compliments. It'll get bigger.
No way. I'm going the other way.
Cool. TechCrunch.com. She's a culture writer for TechCrunch. And of course, Kathy Gelis is here, expert on many things, but we're going to talk about the Supreme Court decisions, the Andy Warhol decision, and then the TAMNA, which is the Twitter decision, and the Google decision. All of which came down. Actually, there was another Supreme Court decision that came down this week. 9-0. We could talk about that. This was a good week for you. Busy week.
It was a weird week.
Were you
busy?
It
was a weird couple of days. Yeah. There was a conference where me and some other people who are in the space were at to even talk about these cases. Like, there was a whole panel. What is going on at the Supreme Court? And basically, we found out, like, 15 minutes before the panel began. So,
how timely is that?
It was actually really interesting because nobody had to feel, everyone felt bad because nobody had time to read anything.
Right.
So,
well, we thought, I think the general thinking was the Supreme Court is going to defer this decision to the very end.
We were expecting this to be
like
a late one, but also with a very different result potentially. Yeah. But Warhol was a very late decision.
And that must have been a gut punch for you.
Oh, it was terrible.
That's
yes,
not what
I will
mean.
Explain why it was terrible.
Yeah. Yeah, bad for fair use. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. Also, Harry McCracken, the Technologizer. It's great to have you. Number of people in the chat room said, Twit's over? No, just beginning. Just don't get your hopes up. Just beginning. Our show today brought to you by Grammarly and something new from Grammarly, Grammarly Go. First of all, props to Grammarly. They are a Ukraine company. It's been a very tough time for them, but they make one of the best products out there. And I love Grammarly for that. They're from Ukraine, but also I love them because they do their core product in Lisp. I love them for that. And now there's Grammarly Go. Today we're working and communicating faster than ever. But a lot of times when you're sitting down to that blank page, it's tough, right? You feel a little stuck. Have you ever had that happen? Whether you're writing a thank you note or a business plan, then you're going to like this new Grammarly Go. I've been trying it in beta. This is Grammarly's new communication assistant, powered by, yes, the hot topic, generative AI. You'll compose intelligently. You could type a prompt into Grammarly Go. It will generate high-quality writing. You can spend less time on wordsmithing. You can personalize it into your voice. There's actually, and Grammarly's always been good at this, tone, choosing the right tone, right? There is a set voice or tone indicator at the top of the Grammarly Go window. You can personalize your tone. So you can say, I want this to be casual or neutral or formal. Or you can say, I want this to be personable, confident, empathetic, engaging, witty, or direct. Grammarly Go will understand your unique context, your preferred voice, and your goals, and will generate high-quality writing quickly. It just takes a few clicks to ideate, compose, rewrite, and thoughtfully reply. You can rewrite for tone, clarity, and length. Give Grammarly Go a paragraph. We've always been, I love this feature of Grammarly, and it will help you fine-tune your writing to reflect your personal style and the tone that you're trying to attain, right? Be effective in any situation. You can select the text you want to rewrite. Activate Grammarly Go. Let it do it. It'll rewrite your paragraph to sound more formal if you want, or more exciting, or more professional, or more inspirational. And you know, you got to try this because it really, really works. It's super cool. You'll be amazed at what you could do with Grammarly Go. Go to grammarly.com/go. You can download it. Learn more about Grammarly Go. G-R-A-M-M-A-R-L-Y, grammarly.com/go. For me, because I think I'm a good writer, I love it because I apply it to something I've written already, and it cleans up any little, you know, confusion, not just grammar anymore. Now it's like, well, that was a little confusing. Let's break that into two sentences, makes it clear. It's really good at kind of refining what you write. Or if you're looking at that blank page going, I don't know where to start. It's a great way to get started, and then the juices flow and you can write. Grammarly, I love it, .com/go. Give it a try today. All right. I've been putting it off. Should I put off a little more and talk about Montana? No. Actually, I do want to talk about Montana because Montana banned TikTok this week.
It thinks it did.
First of all, there's a thing called the First Amendment, right?
There's also the practical implementation of
how do you even do it?
Right.
Many states have already said if you're a state employee, you can't use TikTok on your state-provided phone. I don't have a problem with that. Military do it, too. That's fine. You shouldn't be TikToking when you're working anyway.
I think that's harder to say because you get, should AOC not be TikToking? She TikToks as part of her work.
It's communication. Yeah.
So
that's a good point.
I think it's less legally fraught to have such a rule, but it may not actually be good internal policy to have such a rule and possibly also therefore run into some constitutional problems as well. But in theory, state to state, like we're governing our own property makes a little bit more sense legally.
Very hard for one state to say, okay, nobody in Montana can use TikTok. I don't even know where would you begin? And by the way, the fine is significant. It's $10,000 per incident. So the first people who would act, I guess, would be Apple and Google, who would then say, are you in Montana? Well, you can't get the TikTok app on our
phone. One thing that has not happened, although I think there might be some runway before this actually kicks in.
January 1st.
So, you know, like how many people are there actually in Montana? If Google has done some geo-blocking before with stupid local jurisdictional rules that have tried to govern it in stupid ways.
Spain
with turning off the news. So they might do that. But in the meantime, there's at least one legal challenge that's been filed so far.
This is interesting because TikTok decided not to sue on its own behalf. But it's very clear what they probably did is they went to five Montana TikTok creators and said, you know, this is going to be a problem, isn't it? So they have TikTok users and creators challenging it. That's a little, from a First Amendment point of view, that's probably more sensible, yeah?
Well, I don't know if TikTok is officially sitting it out, but to steer a corporate ship is hard. Right. And there's a lot of considerations that you have to do. I'd like to see companies be a lot more aggressive and challenge a lot of these state laws, but there's reasons why, and some not completely unreasonable reasons why they're more cautious in what they do. I don't know if they necessarily had any conversation with the TikTokers themselves. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. But this, it, I looked at it briefly. I mean, one of the things you're always going to have is, you know, standing questions of, are these people affected in the way that they would even be able to challenge this? Although I think there's certainly a colorable argument. They
five Montana residents who, quote, create, publish, view, interact with, and share videos on TikTok.
Yeah, I mean,
that sounds like standing.
I think it gets in the door. And First Amendment standing is supposed to be more expansive anyway, so that does look like an injury that's likely to be accrued. And that's interesting that they're Montana residents. So I don't know what will happen to it, but it certainly looks colorable.
My feeling is TikTok is watching, and if they don't have to sue, they won't. It's interesting, NetChoice, who has sued in other First Amendment cases, I think in Texas and Florida, is saying right now, we don't have plans to sue. I think everybody's hoping the creators will step forward.
Well, NetChoice is doing a California lawsuit. NetChoice has already filed a lawsuit challenging the age-appropriate design law that California had.
Good, because that's a terrible law.
And, I mean, I think that's a thing of NetChoice as an entity is showing up kind of, they're a trade association, but they're showing up and they're actually bringing some of these challenges. And the question is, will the rest of the industry, you know, back them up on this? Because I think it's absolutely the right move. Like, I think companies end up thinking like, well, can I survive this? But that's too short term in their thinking, because maybe you can survive this particular piece of crap, but you can't survive the whole onslaught.
So the state of Montana, through a spokesperson for the AG, said that they want to use geofencing to prevent the use of TikTok in Montana. Build a wall. That sounds like
they will have to kind of build the Great Firewall of Montana.
Yeah, if
they
the really Great Firewall of Montana.
I mean, what,
it's so interesting too. I mean, like, Kathy, I would be interesting what you would have to say about this, but like another like state-specific legal issue I've been following is certain states passing legislation that in order to access certain adult websites, you need to verify your age, but you're verifying your age through a government app. And
this is the California.
I think there's pretty,
California,
you know,
started Utah, then doubled down on it.
Right.
And, yeah, I think
this
Louisiana,
was something
that
maybe
but
UK is about to do. And
it seems like there's just a lot of legislation right now that's like very state specific regulating how people are using the internet. And I don't know. I just find that really interesting and kind of scary. But yeah, I feel like
is it not
a lot of this internet legislation
is it
like
not trying to regulate interstate commerce or no?
There are so many problems with this. I mean, there's the pure First Amendment problem there when you start to use the the First Amendment problem also shows up in a couple of ways. One of which is the imposition on the platforms and who the platforms can associate with and who they can speak to and what their use and who they can have their users.
So their First Amendment rights.
So their First Amendments, it's impinging on speakers because it's going to essentially keep them off the internet. And it's impinging particularly on anonymous speakers because you don't get to speak anonymously if you have to prove yourself to people.
Right.
It starts to create privacy problems because now you're collecting all sorts of really private sensitive data. You might be
like you have to go in and get your porn license.
Now you've got some Fourth Amendment problems.
That.
You might have some Fifth Amendment problems. I mean, this is disastrous in every way you can look at it. And it's also like there's no way to run an intercommerce railroad like this because you can't. This is why we have a preemption clause in Section 230. It also tends to run straight into Section 230. But that was where Section 230 was starting to get weakened by courts who tended to see a lot more things percolating out of the states as being like, oh, no, this isn't preempted. This isn't preempted. And I think they're wrong, and I think the effect of that is going to be you can see the harm of each state doing things, because how do you deal with what Texas wants of internet platforms to do and what California wants, although California is busy picking the same things that Utah wants, so it's all very confusing.
Apple and Google have said through a trade group before this ban was approved that they did not think it possible to restrict access to an app to a single state. Like, they didn't think there was a technical way to do that.
It seems tough. I mean, but would we see less of this stuff on the state level if at the federal level people have spent less time yapping and more time actually coming up with laws, if any laws make sense?
Well, the problem is Congress is busy trying to also wreck the internet, but better that they wreck it at the federal level than they wreck it at the state level.
It's wrecked for all of us.
Yeah. I mean,
instead of just Montana.
I mean, because otherwise there's always going to be a compliance issue. And what tech companies can't do, what platforms can't do, is respond to one state and also all 50 states, because it's even not only just the 50 states. If you start to allow state jurisdiction over the internet, then it's state and local and municipality, and it's like, you know, you can't cabin this in, because like Texas could have one rule and Austin could have another rule, and this is not viable.
Joe in our Discord makes a good point, and I don't know historically how long this has been going on, but it seems like lately anyway a lot more laws are created as theater, not with any intent of passing any constitutional review or getting past courts, but just because, well, we said it. So, you know, you can trust us. We did the right thing. It feels like a lot of theatrics.
It feels very performative in a lot of cases.
Performative, yeah.
Yeah.
I am not sure. That sounds almost too benign. I mean, I think there's an aspect.
I think it's worse than that.
I think it's worse than that. But what's a little bit confusing is that, so I think from the red states, I mean, if they're busy banning books, then they're going to have to ban the internet too, because you haven't effectively like shut down kids' minds unless you take away all the stuff that they're reading. What it boggles the mind, though, is what's coming out of blue states. I don't understand what Governor Newsom is thinking in that, like, he basically produced just a slightly lighter version of what Utah ended up doing, what Texas ended up doing. And
no one said Republicans had a monopoly on foolishness.
It'd be nice if there was a political opposition that actually wanted to sort of say, wait, the attacks on the constitutional order is a problem, so our political platform will be not to do that.
This is why I give money to the EFF. You know, there are a lot of trade organizations that are, you know, trying to do the right thing. Maybe not our member representative democracy.
I think, but also they don't necessarily understand exactly what will break.
I think that's also the case.
I think that's fundamentally true of every regulator that wants to speak to it, including members of Congress who are kind of like, something must be done, and just have no idea that, no, you're going to just make the problem you think you're fixing worse, and they don't know. And what really bothers me is the ones who refuse to learn.
You said an interesting phrase, something must be done. That's what's really going on. We don't know how to do it. We don't know if we can do it, but something must be done.
I understand.
I feel like we see this happening with the Kids Online Safety Act, where that was pretty much a direct response to the Facebook whistleblowers and the situation with like all these bombshell articles about Instagram being an agent of depression and eating disorders in teenage girls. But then like, it's just like this same, to the point of like theatricality. It's like, yeah, if you say Kids Online Safety Act, no one's going to be like, that's bad. But then when you think about it and what this would do is like any situation where people are putting age checks and checking people's actual like government identification in order to do anything on the internet, there are so many really scary implications of that. And no one's arguing against kids' safety, but the way that these laws play out in practice, you can really tell that the people that are writing them don't know how the internet works. And
but they don't,
to Kathy's
care.
Point, yeah,
it's frustrating.
It's
problem.
Like, there have been so many, like, I've watched so many hearings over the last two or so years about how social media is making everyone depressed. And I think that is like something that's worth talking about. But nothing has even come of these hearings yet, other than like some proposed legislations that won't really fix much.
These hearings are performative.
They've had so much time to learn about the internet.
But they're not learning. I mean, talk about the theatrics.
Yeah, and they're
these
not.
Hearings are performative, where people bring in speakers who can speak to their preordained biases.
Or worse, they bring in somebody and then grandstand and don't let them speak. It's just an opportunity for a member of Congress to go on for his full 10 minutes.
Yeah. There's not a whole lot of rigorous inquiry going on here, and there's not a whole lot of interest in rigorous inquiry. And then we get things, and I'm, you know, to be political, I listen to like Senator Blumenthal talking about like, I've been trying for years to make changes to 230, and now will finally be the time. It's like, no, the reason you've not been able to pull that off is because smart people have managed
you.
To stop you because it was a bad idea. It doesn't mean that the time will come where your good idea will survive. It will still not be a good idea.
It's co-sponsor with Marsha Blackburn, Dick Blumenthal of the Kids
and Josh
Online
Hawley.
Safety Act. I mean, it's a, yeah, when you see Marco Rubio's name and right next to Amy Klobuchar or Hickenlooper's, it's like, well,
at least there's bipartisan support, I guess.
I have a Tectored post from January 2001, I think, where it's Dear Section 230 critics, when Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz are your allies in this, it's time to think again.
Yeah.
Because they know exactly why they want to get rid of this law and exactly what it'll advance. Not,
that's why it's bipartisan. They have different agendas. But the agendas happen to meet in the middle.
And I listened to that hearing where Josh Hawley is smart and he knows that he's getting political support from Blumenthal for what he wants.
Right.
And I can listen to him kind of like, oh, yes, I'm totally doing it to advance that women's rights issue that you just were speaking of. And Blumenthal doesn't seem to understand that he's getting played.
Sigh.
It's all just a series of tubes. It always has.
Yeah, remember that? This is why we're all playing Tears of the Kingdom right now, right? Amanda, you're playing Tears of the Kingdom, I bet.
Oh, my God. So this is...
you have to for your work.
A horrible confession.
Mom,
but
I have to play Zelda for my work.
Wait, what's her confession?
tell Matthew Panzerino that right now. No, just kidding. But, no, I mean, like, so I have not finished Breath of the Wild. That is my big confession.
The predecessor.
So I have not started Tears of the Kingdom.
Because it's the sequel. It's the same game.
Yeah,
Amanda, I'm just going to tell you. It's the same game, same place. You're still in Hyrule. Yeah, you're still wandering around. You could play them both at the same time.
I really should be playing it.
I'm not done yet.
I don't
yet.
Know. Breath of the Wild, just...
I'm not like, done. I'm not
I
done with Animal Crossing New Horizons.
Getting the paraglider.
I cannot play anything till I finish my Animal Crossings town. And then...
Well, you can't ever finish it.
Oh, shucks.
I never finish games, so I didn't finish... Breath of the Wild, and I am playing Tears of the Kingdom, despite that.
Yeah, well, I win, because I'm not even... I
you don't even know
start
what we're talking about, right, probably.
Yeah.
10 million copies sold in 3 days. The Switch itself is practically at the end of life.
And it's sales of new Switches have been disappointing lately. But games for the Switches people already have are still doing well.
And many are saying this is the best game ever made. 10 out of 10. In many cases.
This was also the standard price for Switch games that are like Pokemon or Zelda or like big franchises like that is $60. But this was the first time that they sold a game for $70. And it's still, great financial decision for Nintendo. They still sold an insane amount of copies. But
to put this in perspective, Breath
of
the
Wild. For the consumer, a little concerning.
The Breath of the Wild only sold 30 million copies in its entire lifetime, you know, 4-year lifetime. 3 days, 10 million copies on Tears of the Kingdom. I imagine there'll be people going back and playing Breath of the Wild, too.
I just like to note for the record, I had an Atari 800. Yeah. I played video games then. I had Pac-Man. I did Caverns of Mars. We had Breakout. I mean, I've got some cred, but like after that, like,
too,
what did you know, got out of my system. What do I need this for now?
All right, let's take a break.
I'm playing those games too, by the way, on my Atari 800, which I have.
Oh, three Atari people. That's great. That was my first computer, was a 400.
My first console
was your first?
Nintendo 64.
Yeah. You're an N64. You're a Mario kid. I bet you're going to play. Did you go see the Mario movie
yet? When did the Atari 800 came out?
Oh, you don't even want to
know. I have not, but I do want to see it because I have heard that it is good. I also think it's very funny that Mario and Luigi apparently are canonically from Flatbush, Brooklyn, which I'm just very happy to know what neighborhood of Brooklyn they live in. I really wanted to know, and I found out.
Yeah, we played Donkey Kong where it came from,
in an arcade, game with sticks.
I think we had one for the Atari, but it wasn't as old as Pac-Man.
It wasn't
Pac-Man
as good
first.
As the arcade version. Amanda, this
I'm
came
so
out before you were
to
born.
Share this,
this is before you were born. Amanda.
Oh yeah, no, I literally just fact checked this. It was discontinued before I was born.
Discontinued before you were born.
That's like a lyric to a song.
The Atari 800 was discontinued before I was born. That's
I love
gonna
it.
Write a poem right
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
Let's
yeah.
go.
The Atari 400 was the first computer I bought with my own money, by
Me
the way,
too.
Leo.
Me too. Because I was playing a lot of games in the arcade, and I realized all these quarters I've just dropped, if I bought an Atari 400, I could play Battlezone to my heart's content.
And I still have my 400. And it's
Do
still,
you?
My friend Ben Edwards, who works for Ars Technica, recently repaired it for me.
I'm so jealous.
The crummy keyboard stopped working, and
he
swapped
keyboard.
In a replacement
that's
keyboard.
Why I got an 800
I think we have an 800, but it had a sticky select key, so I'm wondering if that can get fixed, because I think we still have it.
I bet you can.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sad. I long ago got rid of all of those. Yeah. I'm sorry, Amanda, you have to be with all these old farts, but that's okay. That's life.
No, I mean, I just had a birthday, and I'm like, I don't know. I know I'm young, but it's like every year closer I get to 30, I'm like,
I know.
What am I doing?
I know.
Like,
what am I doing?
So
someday you two could be on a show waxing poetic about video games you played in your youth.
But I'll be dead by then.
I just exploit people to make me feel like I haven't aged.
It's good. You feel young, and that's all that matters.
Yes, thank you. What position I'm very happy to be in this company.
What position do you play in your softball league?
I play second base.
Nice.
Oh, that's a good position.
Do you range the field? Yep. Do they still allow the shift in softball?
A little bit. I do tend to shift more closer to up the middle when there's a righty batter, which is often.
Good job.
But then the lefties, they get me. But
every time.
Yeah, my team is called the Hamantaschen, which, for those who don't know, is a Jewish cookie. And I am Jewish, but
a prune-filled
there are only three Jewish people on the
poppy
team.
Seed. Yeah.
Well, I don't have Section 230 to worry about, I can complain about the new rules in Major League Baseball, which just exorcises me completely.
When you play in the Hamantaschen, do you wear tricorn hats to match your...
Yes, the Hamantaschen. I did just get a hat that, like, a Jewish artist made that's, like, it's just a hat that is embroidered and says Hamantaschen.
Oh, wow.
But unfortunately, I debuted it on the field today. And I realized that when I run, it would fall off. So I need to do a little bit of like testing and like hat tightening before our next game. So that's what I'm doing outside of work.
The aerodynamics of a regular baseball cap are not great. So I think they're supposed to fall off.
Before your time, both of you probably, but the great Willie Mays used to wear a cap that was one size too big. So that when he made a running catch out in the outfield and his cap flew off, he looked much more dynamic.
Ooh.
He was quite famous for that, actually. The famous basket catch. Let's take a little break. We'll come back with more with this sports-addled group. But first...
We're not playing the video games anymore. We're getting out and getting fresh air.
First a word.
I'm doing both.
Just open the window. That's fresh air. First a word from our sponsor, Noom. I'm a big Noom fan. My wife, Lisa, is a big Noom fan. I started it. I saw all those TV ads a couple of years ago. I said, you know, that looks like a good thing. Actually, it took about 20 of them before I said, that looks like a good thing. I should try it. Signed up. It's not a diet. I said, I'm going to be doing Noom, Lisa. And she said, you know what? I'm going to be a good wife. I don't need to lose any weight, but I'm going to do it with you. She has now lost and kept off about 12 pounds. I lost about 16 and kept it off. Actually, I think it was closer to 20. I gained back a few of those, but I'm still 16 pounds down. But it's not from dieting. Noom, you know, these fad diets and health trends come and go. But Noom is not a fad. It's not a diet. It's psychology, and that's why it works. Psychology that helps you make intentional, sustainable choices aligned with your values and your weight loss goals. So Noom uses well-known, established psychological techniques to help you understand what your eating choices are and why you have cravings. I, for instance, I'm a fog eater. I'll sit down. I come home from work and I'll just start stuffing my face. I don't even know I ate it. And afterwards, I don't even know I ate it. It's a complete fog. It's unconscious eating. One of the things Lisa and I do now is we put the fork down in between bites. We chew. We don't have the TV on. We don't have the phone in front of us. We just sometimes we close our eyes and taste the food. It makes such a difference. It's little things. That's mine. Everybody's journey is different. Noom will give you daily lessons personalized to your goals, your needs. They use scientific principles like cognitive behavioral therapy so you understand your relationship with food, why you have cravings, why you can't seem to change what you're doing. But there's not a diet. It's nourishing, not restrictive. It focuses on progress, not perfection. You can have days off. You can eat anything you want. I remember early on in Noom, I had a hot dog and I felt so guilty. I messaged my coach, my Noom coach, and I said, I had a hot dog. I'm sorry. She said, what are you talking about? There's no forbidden food. That's okay. That's okay. You choose your level of support, by the way. You can have that coach 5-minute daily check-ins. You can have personal coaching. You can have group. There's a group. You can get as much or as little of the lessons as you want. Days off, totally okay, because progress isn't a straight line. You just want to do it day, as you do it consistently. It's been a couple of years now for Lisa and me. It's really amazing. Maintenance is even better because I've learned, I've internalized all the lessons, right? And if you get off track, Noom gets you back on track. First time Noomers lose an average of 15 pounds in 16 weeks. 95% of customers say Noom is a good long-term solution. Of course, your mileage may vary, but they are, it's based in science. They've published 50 scientific peer-reviewed articles describing their methods and their effectiveness. So stop chasing health trends. Start building sustainable, healthy habits with Noom's psychology-based approach. I can tell you it works. Sign up for your trial today. Noom, Noom.com/twit. Noom.com/twit. Check out Noom's first ever book. It's out now. The Noom Mindset might be a good way to start. Get the book and read about their psychology of behavior change. It explains how it all works wherever books are sold. And don't forget to sign up for your trial at Noom, Noom.com/twit. It really, really works. And I love them. Thank you, Noom, for supporting the show. All right, we got to talk about the Supreme Court. I've been putting it off. It's like dessert. I've been like putting it off. That's dessert. So there were a number of the Supreme Court. What is it? Second Tuesday in October. They meet in October, right? They do the arguments, and then they think, and then the opinions start coming out.
I mean, in theory, they trail at some reasonable amount of time after you hear the oral argument. But this one they heard in October, and there had been no opinion until May. And that was an unusually long delay, I think. Yeah. Although everything about how this particular iteration of the court likes to do things is there's past practice and then there's this court.
Yeah, we won't talk about the shadow docket. That's a whole
another
matter entirely. Do you want to start with, the Andy Warhol case?
Well, yes? Do you want to do the good news or the bad news first?
Let's state the facts of the case.
Okay, well, the Warhol is the all bad news case. The other stuff on the 230 front was the surprisingly good news case.
Yeah, let's start with the bad news first.
All right, oh gosh.
So, photographer Lynn Goldsmith in 1981 took a picture of Prince.
Yes.
That's what's on the left if you're watching the video. Andy Warhol on a commission from
Variety, I think.
I can't remember. Yeah. It was a Condé Nast publication.
Condé Nast ended up later, and I don't know but I don't know
if there's Vanity Fair later. Anyway, they commissioned these 16 silkscreen images, clearly taken from the original Lynn Goldsmith photograph. And the position of Andy Warhol's estate was, and your position too, right? You wrote an amicus brief for this one.
So Andy Warhol made those silkscreen adaptations of the Goldsmith photo while he was alive. At some point while he was alive, and I think he died in 1987.
It's hard to make them when you're not alive. Let's just
and
say
that.
That. I'll stipulate that,
that is
Your Honor.
Largely overlooked in this decision, and it sort of should matter. And I don't mean sort of. It should have mattered. So essentially, they describe briefly the successor in interest to him, which was he had a foundation, the Andy Warhol Foundation. I guess basically owns the copyrights in his works. And he was approached by Condé Nast because Prince now had died and they wanted to do an article about him. And they had a choice of like,
You said he was alive, you didn't mean Andy Warhol, you meant Prince.
Sorry, no, Andy Warhol. Okay.
I was confused. I thought she said Andy Warhol made these prints while he was alive. You meant while Prince was alive.
No, Andy Warhol, when he was alive, made his own works. He did not make them after he died. And that
makes sense.
Okay.
That's how it's usually done,
so
I think.
Also was alive.
Because he made the prints. It's also confusing because there's Prince.
The Prince.
He made the silk screens. We'll go with that. He made the silk screens.
The images.
He made the images and while he was alive and they got published somewhere, but then
and everything was okay then.
And everything apparently was okay.
Nobody complained. Lynn Goldsmith didn't complain. Nobody complained.
Right. Then 20 years after Warhol died, Prince now died. And so Condé Nast wanted to illustrate the article they had on Prince. And they went to the Andy Warhol Foundation, which now was the successor in interest for the rights in Andy Warhol's works. And they said, can we license that? And the foundation said, great, give us $10,000, I think. And then Goldsmith found out about this and started to threaten them in some way. And so the foundation sued for declaratory judgment to say, well, this should be fair use, so you shouldn't have a leg to stand on, and let's just have the courts rule on this now. And the district court said, you're right, it's fair use, nothing to see here. And then the Second Circuit undid that in a decision that really abandoned what the Supreme Court had said in the Campbell versus Acuff-Rose case, which was the one where Two Live Crew had... had
sampled the music,
satirized the Oh Pretty Woman, Roy Orbison's song.
Ah. Although, by the way, that word satirized.
Yeah, I may actually be saying it wrong, whether it's satirize or parody, but I think it's all dumb either way you slice it, so I hate to give it that dignity.
If they just used it in the production, that wouldn't be fair use. But if they were satirizing or parodying it, like Weird Al does, that would be fair use. But only... Because the only reason I say this is because we are always thinking about fair use here, only if it parodies the original creator of it.
So it
you can't use it to make another a separate. It's too
well,
who,
well, no, I mean, it's also too hard to figure out what the court just said. But in theory, the idea is in the fair use in the statute, it talks about one of the things that makes things more likely to be fair use is if it's commentary. And so the interpretation is, okay, if you're commenting on the original, you got to be able to use the original. So
then
that's more likely.
Yes.
It is less clear whether commenting on anything else would be fair use. And this decision seems to drive a stake through the heart of the idea that you could comment on anything else using a previously existing work. But that's going to fall apart in practice and be awfully chilling for anybody who... The expression
Just we're using this phrase. I want to explain what it is so people understand what the phrase fair use is. It is not a law, but it's a doctrine, right? It's a point of view that says you can, in a limited fashion, use somebody else's copyrighted material without permission... providing it satisfies one of
it
what
is it? Part of the law.
It is in the law.
It is in the law. So before the
17 USC 107.
Yeah, before the 1976 Act, it was interpreted to be part of the law.
But it's now in 76.
But they codified it. They used a lot of what the factors the judges were using to consider whether something was fair use or not, and then they baked them into the statute with the 1976 Act, which is. Basically what we're using now. And so fair use is there. It is part of the law, and it inherently... So what's in the law is if you have a copyright, there's some exclusive rights you get as part of a copyright subject to other limitations, including the ones articulated in 107, and 107 talks about fair use. So fair use, and courts go back and forth with good language or bad language, but that though in... There is a take on this that your copyright is inherently limited by things that the public can still do.
And there's reasons for that, because it's in society's interest. There's two interests, conflicting interests. The creator of the original work has an interest in protecting their rights so they can sell it. And you know, they made it, so they own it. But society also has a right that it may be reused in other fashion. I mean, you know, we wouldn't have Cinderella... if Grimm's fairy tales didn't create that notion.
The whole point to have copyright at all is we want more stuff. And so we think we have to protect creators a little bit so that they will produce the stuff that we need. But now we've taken the stuff away. Like, what's the point? So the question is, what's the tipping point? What does the law need to do so we do get more stuff?
Society's interest is that, well, we use all of this stuff to create new stuff.
Well, we want,
by the way, this is going to become important artificial intelligence later. But anyway, this is why it's a big deal. So Goldsmith's able to take this photo of Prince and have some rights. In fact, she did license it for $400 to Vanity Fair originally. But then they reused it 20 years later when Prince died. They reused the Andy Warhol things. And Goldsmith said, you didn't pay for that. I still have the rights to it. So the real question was... is this Andy Warhol creation protected by fair use?
And the court really botched that. And I think the reason that they botched it, well, there were a couple, that's a weird thing, why they botched it. But the big fundamental thing that I think they got wrong, and I've not seen this discussed in many other quarters, so other people may disagree, but they ended up focusing on the later license to Condé Nast as the use. But it wasn't the use of the original. Fair use applies to the use of the original, which is what Andy Warhol himself did, I guess, in the 1980s when he made the adaptation of the Goldsmith picture. He used it in a way to say something new about Prince. And then he goes and he dies and he's dead for 20 years. And then later, the party that ends up owning the copyrights in his new
works,
the
Andy Warhol Foundation,
start to use his works. And they judged fair use based on a use of his work and construed it to be a use of the original. And I think that burned down an awful lot. And I think that's a really big deal. And I think it's a really big deal that will blow up on copyright owners because they are a copyright owner in his subsequent work. And sleeping on something that they own, they think is fine. And later they go on to actually exploit the copyright in something they think they own. And then they're going to be called on the carpet to say that the thing you thought you owned actually turns out, I guess, to be infringing. And now I think it leaves the question of, well, then, are they liable for infringement to Goldsmith? Does Goldsmith inherently own the Warhol work? Because even the court leaves the door open to the fact that Warhol himself, when he made that adaptation, may have actually been fair use for whatever was filling his mind about what his motivation was. Like, this is not a sustainable rubric for understanding these things.
So I'm confused.
So is the court.
Yeah.
So there's a picture. Mm-hmm. Goldsmith owns the rights to that picture. Andy Warhol makes
He adapts the picture.
Adapts it.
Yeah.
That's okay, according to the court.
It could be, according to the court.
Because that's transformative.
As they ran their four-factor analysis test, which is the things that courts
rules.
Used to use, that's now in the statute. According, as the court did it, it said, well, based on facts that are not present here, yeah, he still could be considered fair use.
It's fair use because it's transformative.
It
so
could be.
Who's
never
at fault? So Goldsmith sued the Andy Warhol Foundation over the publishing of these pictures in Vanity Fair.
The licensing of the Warhol version for Vanity
so
Fair.
So her contention was, well, Andy could make these pictures, but the Andy Warhol Foundation may not license them.
Apparently somehow that was different.
Okay. And the court agreed. So the court isn't saying you can't make transformative works of somebody's photograph. But you can't license it?
I mean, it's very strange what the court is doing. I mean, let's say, I think there's a huge fundamental problem with the way the court ends up viewing the term use and where the fair use is, because it's really about the copier's use. And this idea that the Warhol Foundation was somehow the copier when they didn't make the work, they just ended up owning the rights of the work that Warhol made. So Warhol is the person who made the use of the original, and arguably fairly, because he used it to say something else. So I think by breaking it down, you break the sustainability of copyright law, including for copyright holders. But it was also done, and the other really toxic thing about this decision is this idea of, well, how dare you make money from it? That when they ran the four-factor test about commerciality, it really, it just basically meant that it resulted in, if you make of fair use for free, you're fine. But if you want to make money from it, you're not fine. But that matters.
This is what Sotomayor wrote. She said, Goldsmith's original photograph of Prince and the Andy Warhol Foundation's copying use of that photograph in an image share substantially the same purpose, and the use of is of a commercial nature.
Because it was like, oh, you're just making pictures of Prince to license to a magazine, as if these are both two same
things.
But
Warhol did not make that picture to license it to a magazine.
No, so somehow his intent 20 years later
was not commercial.
Is construed to now be the Warhol Foundation's. None of this makes sense temporally. But the other thing, and actually I need to criticize Kagan, who wrote a really scathing and correct dissent. There's 87 pages of this PDF that got produced by the court. I did a search for First Amendment, and I've also read it. I don't think the term shows up at all. And the really important thing about, like, what is the goals and purpose of copyright? We're trying to stimulate the creation of more of this stuff. But part of the reason we have fair use is because it is the codification of the First Amendment interest. Because what are we doing with exclusive rights, taking away what the public can do, but essentially impinging on expression? And that's got to, the First Amendment still exists even in the wake of copyright. And there's other Supreme Court precedent that talks about how fair use is the vindication of the free expression values that the First Amendment is making sure that Congress doesn't get to step on. And they're stepping on it because now all of a sudden, if you want to make subsequent expression that uses something else that came before, you're going to be in trouble, especially if you want to monetize it. And there's nothing in the First Amendment that says you don't get to make money off of your expression, because I'm something you have to, because it's the only way you're going to keep the lights on. This is
so a Justice
mess.
Kagan and Chief Justice John Roberts were the two dissenters.
Right.
She said it will stifle creativity of every sort. It will impede new art and music and literature. It will thwart the expression of new ideas and the attainment of new knowledge. It will make our world poorer. That's accurate.
She's absolutely right. And I don't understand why Justice Sotomayor, who normally is one of my favorite justices, who normally sees things really clearly in all their implications, is so blind to this. And it
seems to be the difference is this commercial use.
I mean, that seems to be the thing. The photographer's like, I made a picture and I didn't get to license it the second time around because there was a second picture that used mine. So I lost a market opportunity and that was not fair. And that's basically what the court is like. You're right.
That's one of the four tests, right? Is it doesn't that the derivative work doesn't impinge on your market opportunity.
It's not the way it's phrased. And so that's part of the problem. This case was like, what are the four factors say and what do they end up meaning? Because the effect on the commercial market of the original work matters for the inquiry, but the degree it's supposed to matter is, as Kagan pointed out and the foundation would point out, it's not supposed to eat the whole, because the first factor is about was it transformative? Did it bring something new to the table, a new message? And what Kagan is screaming at Sotomayor about is like, of course it brought something new. So when Condé Nast had a choice about what image to run to illustrate
the
story,
new one.
They wanted the new one.
They didn't want the photo.
Because they say different things. They illustrate Prince, the musical artist, in a very different way.
It is the case that the first test, and this is from 17 U.S.C. 107, in determining whether the use made of a work in any particular case is fair use, the factors to be considered shall include, doesn't mean limited to, but shall include, the purpose and character of the use, including whether such use is of commercial nature. I mean, it does say that.
It does say that. And what this court has done is interpreted it in a way where it just eats the whole and shuts everything down. It also makes me wonder what happens to the author of an original work who made it with no intention to modify it. Is all of a sudden their copyright weaker than somebody who produced a work to modify it? Court doesn't answer that question.
Interesting.
I mean, there's a whole lot of hand-waving over some really significant issues that are not addressed by this court.
How sweeping was this decision?
So we're not entirely sure. This may be a decision that is so bad it might end up being a nothing burger. No, it is a precedent, but it may end up being so weird that basically like everybody just ignores it and we carry on with stuff as we did. So that's one Pollyannish take. I've seen some of my friends who try to advocate for fair uses and things like that talk about how, well, it's kind of rested on its facts and it's more narrow, that, commerciality is an important thing. And so that will, in theory, help a lot of the more nonprofit uses that don't want to get obliterated by litigation, that if you take the money out of the equation, in theory, this decision doesn't really hurt them. I just think it makes such a mess out of everything doctrinally that we are all in trouble, including the copyright holders.
So this is kind of like, okay, let's say, so Michael Jackson did a song called Bad. Mm-hmm. Weird Al Yankovic did a derivative work of it called Fat, mm-hmm. which is fair use. Actually, he got permission from Michael Jackson.
He tends to get permission.
But that he didn't have to. That's probably fair use.
Probably he's never litigated it.
Okay.
He doesn't litigate it. He had one song, I think, where he didn't get the permission and then they got mad at him, so he felt bad.
Let's say then I played Bad on the show Fat on the show to talk about weight loss. Let's say I played it in the Numad. Now, it would make sense if Weird Al sued me because that was his song I was using. But if the Michael Jackson estate sued me saying, well, that derivative work was based on Bad, so you screwed us, but I wasn't using it to illustrate Bad. I was using it to illustrate Fat. Is this kind of analogous to what we just saw? And by the way, I'm doing it commercially because I sell ads. It's for an ad.
I think the upshot to this decision is that could be a problem. And I don't think that's the way copyright's supposed to work.
Which is a weird problem.
It's a weird problem. And I don't think the court addresses it. I think the court creates that problem. And I don't think that's a vector of litigation liability that's necessarily existed before where we've really had to contend with it. I mean, we're always in a problem of, did you play the song and did that infringe on the copyright based in the song? But I think what they're basically saying is, yeah, I think that's actually a really good analogy of what they've just set up.
Even the original work has
that
has some
the
rights.
Michael Jackson copyright holder could come after you for doing for having played
a derivative work.
Because that may have been fair use in that context, but it's not fair use in the context.
Yes, because I'm doing it commercially now.
And that's going to not help your four-factor analysis, but that because you use the derivative that the copyright holder in the original has some cause of action against you.
That's the same thing that happened just now.
I think that's, and I don't think it's supposed to work that way.
It's very interesting.
Yeah.
I've heard a theory that with this case, there might have been a factor of kind of like modern art. My kid could have done that, which kind of...
Well, that's the question is, did they accept that was a derivative work that Andy Warhol did?
I think they did accept that
Andy Warhol's work was fair use, right? That his work itself was fair use.
I think they said it could be. I mean, and in theory, that wasn't necessarily the facts brought to the case. They weren't talking about what Warhol did to the original, because that wasn't what the litigation... Well, it ended up strange. Somehow it should have been maybe what the litigation was about, but somehow it ended up not being what the litigation was out about by the time it ended up at the Supreme Court. I'm wondering how this happened, and it seems like the court got so fixated on the four factors and how it wanted to interpret the commerciality aspect of it that they just got so lost in the four factors that they lost the forest for the trees in terms of what is actually going on here and what is the implication.
So unfortunately, what they've done is they've really muddied the whole concept.
I think they've muddied things in a really disastrous way, because somebody owns those Weird Al copyrights, and I don't think they're going to be happy to know that they might be in trouble based on issues raised by whoever he parodied in the first place. And I think that's a vector of attack that this decision sets up.
That's really
I also think it's really interesting to think about how this is going to have implications in tech, because I mean, what's going to happen with all of these like AI Drake voice situations? Or I've written about fair use and copyright law a little bit in the context of fan communities. Like, there was a Bridgerton musical, and
that's right, they got shut down. That was on TikTok. Yeah.
Yeah, but that actually, so I had written about the case when Netflix had sued the people that created the Bridgerton musical, which was basically just like these two songwriters on TikTok writing songs like in real time on the app. And then they made an album, and then the album won a Grammy, I believe.
Yes.
But I think they settled the case because, I mean, I might be wrong, but the last time I looked at it, I think they settled the case. But there are a lot of precedents, there's a lot of, like, conversation about this in the context of, like, fan fiction, where Archive of Our Own, which is like a really big fan fiction website, they literally were like created in tandem with copyright lawyers to figure out like, how can we protect 16-year-olds writing about like whatever book they're interested in, when it's like you can't even link to a Venmo or like a coffee on AO3 because so Netflix, they are so afraid of getting sued.
Netflix settled. Which mm-hmm. so it really we don't know what happened, and the court never got to decide on this.
Yeah.
Netflix settled, but yeah, they were and, that's I a mean, really interesting also, case.
And I think similarly with what we were talking about with government officials making legislation about the internet when they don't really know how the internet works, I also feel like that happens with art to an extent where, like, you could write a dissertation on whether or not this Andy Warhol work is like just copying or if it's an original work. And I mean,
the court wasn't really thinking about that. That wasn't really the issue, was whether Andy's work was derivative or not.
They were thinking about it so focused on the photographer that she took a picture to be licensed in a magazine. She was putting her product in the to be licensed to a magazine market space, and a magazine comes along, wants a picture of exactly the same thing that she had taken a picture of, and the court was deeply offended that the subsequent work could somehow take that market opportunity from her because the court just treated them as equivalents, and Kagan in the dissent started screaming at the majority of, like, they're not equivalents.
That's a derivative work. And similarly, Netflix...
That said different
Netflix
things.
Netflix loved the Bridgerton parody when it was on TikTok, but
until
it wasn't
they
until they
it
went
at the Kimmel Center.
It wasn't until they went to the Kennedy Center and had a paying a ticket price for a paying concert that Netflix said they crossed the line that they had tried to establish with Barlow and Bear, the creators of the because Netflix has its own Bridgerton experience, and so in the minds of Bridgerton fans, there was a confusion between the derivative work and the original work.
So one other thing that ends up happening in this space is there's other things that can go wrong, like passing off or rights and publicity issues. Like, there's other things that sort of offend us as, like, wait, maybe that isn't the thing that should happen. But it isn't copyright that solves that problem. It is other legal doctrines and other legal rights that might solve the problem. And we tend to just throw it all under copyright to let copyright fix it, but it ends up contorting copyright, so it stops doing what it's supposed to
right.
do.
We need a public space. We need a public domain, a town square, where all ideas go and can be reworked, because that's how creativity happens.
I mean, Kagan is pointing out in the dissent that we've really impinged on that, that, like, everybody, we already had to look over our shoulder where the joke was fair use is the right to hire a lawyer. Like, there was already a lot of chilling. This decision really would appear to produce more chilling.
It kills the commons.
And I'm thinking about, I haven't seen a whole lot of people make the point that I just made. So stay tuned till next week where, we can see if people take issue with it. But I think it's actually the upshot, and that hurts copyright holders. So even if you buy the idea that copyright holders should have more and stronger rights, I think it just weakened them.
That's really an interesting side effect that.
It makes me wonder. I must be wrong because I can't believe nobody noticed.
Well, it was bad enough on the face of it. They didn't even need to dig any deeper. Yeah. There is an absolute chilling effect. YouTube is very much a part of that. We can't do a lot of the things that I think are, as a news organization, are clearly protected by fair use, because we'll get, rightly or wrongly, we'll get a DMC takedown on YouTube, and then we lose those views.
And there's First Amendment implications of it. You're trying to do expression that normally the First Amendment should protect, so why does copyright get to say no to it?
Right.
And you have to be really careful about what copyright says no to because of the First Amendment, and that's what fair use is supposed to be there, to make sure it doesn't say no to too much.
I guess my point is, maybe we would win in court. We could probably defend it.
Right,
maybe
the right to hire a lawyer. Yeah.
It doesn't matter, because it's too late.
Yeah.
By then, we've already lost any commercial value to the show. So the chilling effect is just taking us down for any length of time.
Yep.
So we don't even dare risk that. Not because we're worried about court. We might win in court.
Right. Well, you don't want to pay those lawyers.
But we can't. Yeah. Even if I wanted to pay the lawyers, the value of the show is gone after a few days. So by virtue, you have the right to appeal, but by virtue of taking it down, and they do, by the way, Content ID takes stuff down immediately. Because it's automated. And we can appeal, but if it's gone for 5 days, we've lost the value anyway. So this is the problem we're in right now. And I don't know what the answer is to it, except...
Well, not this, but the problem is there's a whole lot of people on team, give more to the copyright holders, give more to the copyright holders.
And
the people
on,
I think it's not good for them. I think this case has just created a very real problem for them. Yeah. But, the reason that there's people like me and EFF and Public Knowledge that have been pointing out, like, you have to protect fair use, is because ultimately, there's other people expressing stuff and they need to be able to, and that we've accidentally untuned copyright law, that it's saying no to expression, but the whole point of copyright law is to incentivize expression. How are you incentivizing something that you're chilling with the exact same rules that you're doing? You've got to tune it better, or else there's just no point in having it.
So that was the bad news.
That was the bad news. Also, I feel like nobody on the Supreme Court actually read my amicus brief, because I made these points very clearly, very capably, and they didn't show up anywhere. And I'm really alarmed that the words First Amendment did not show up in any of the 87 pages.
Even Justice Kagan and Roberts didn't.
Even they didn't. And I think it would have helped them possibly win their argument, because ultimately they were kind of talking about the effects, like the First Amendment value in terms of the expression was going to foster. But I think they really needed to doctrinally say this. And we miss Justice Breyer on the court because he actually understood these issues. And he had written really important dissents in some earlier earlier copyright decisions at the court, where he talked about the dance that the copyright law needs to do with the First Amendment, which interestingly Justice Alito signed on to one of them, and now he signed on to the Sotomayor majority. So I don't know what he's thinking these days.
There were two other cases, kind of interlinked cases, that the Supreme Court took, and we talked a lot about it after oral arguments. Gonzalez, I think you were on with us after oral arguments, because you were in the court during oral arguments, which must have been an interesting thing. There were two days in a row. They really were the similar case that for some reason they separated into two different
similar
cases.
Similar fact patterns. They were different cases brought by different plaintiffs that had different cases that came out of the Ninth Circuit.
So they had to separate them?
Well, they were two separate things, and the Ninth Circuit kind of ruled on them together. And then when the cert petitions were filed, Gonzalez, I think, was the one that had the original cert petition. And then Twitter said, we're going to do a conditional one, where if you grant Gonzalez, please do our case too.
Ah. So Gonzalez versus Google and Twitter versus Tamina, in both cases, a terrorist act. The family of a victim sued the social media, trying to hold them liable for the attacks because social media allowed terrorist organizations to have accounts on either, in the case of YouTube, in case of Google was YouTube, and in case of Twitter was Twitter, and that somehow that meant they were liable for.
Yeah, it's all a little vaguer than that, and it depended also on which case. But the general thing is terrorists do bad things, and terrorists are also using the internet. So both cases were built on the theories of internet is being used by terrorists, so therefore internet must be liable in some way for what the terrorists are doing.
And historically, and we've celebrated this many times, the internet is protected by Section 230. Of the DMCA or of the
Communications Decency Act.
I always get it wrong. The CDA, saying that we're not, we just can't be held liable for that, right? Is this so now the Supreme Court, by the way, took the side of Section 230.
They avoided it, but they avoided it in a way that may actually be better. So
they punted.
Well, they punted, but they did better than punting. This was actually sort of, I don't know if I want to say this is absolutely, but best case scenario is actually a reasonable term that some observers are talking about for those of us who wanted to maintain things.
So Tamina was 9-0 in favor of Twitter.
And Google versus Gonzalez v. Google, I don't remember how it's postured. Basically, that one was punted. So that was the one that when I came on and talked about, because this is when I did the brief and I was in the courtroom for, was not well litigated, that the plaintiffs.
It's funny, I thought it was the Google versus Gonzalez that would end up being the.
Well, everybody did.
Gonzalez versus Google. That's the one where we listened to the arguments. You were in the room. That was the one where they at some point said, well, the problem is thumbnails.
Right.
Which was insane.
Which was not the thing that they had argued.
They
changed it. So
they did rule on Tamina, the second case, the Twitter case.
The one that was more conditional that only went along for the ride.
But then said, but based on our ruling in Tamina, there's no underlying cause of action in Gonzalez, so we don't have to think about it.
So a couple of things are happening here. Leading up to this, everyone was really alarmed that either of these cases were taken because...
And it looked like the Supreme Court took them both
with an eye
towards undermining 230, probably.
Right, because in earlier cases, Justice Thomas and eventually joined by probably Alito, I forget, started to get joined by people who were like, we need to take a look at Section 230. We need to take a look at Section 230. And in these companion concurrences they were writing, they were articulating their understanding of Section 230 that was alarmingly wrong. So it looked like they plucked these cases out and decided to take them because they really wanted to make a mess of Section 230. So the internet community was alarmed deeply and did major, major brief work on both these cases as they went to the Supreme Court. But something weird happened. So we went into the courtroom for Gonzalez v. Google, noticed that there were some significant issues in how it was being argued by the plaintiffs and that the court was noticing and that they kept saying, like, let me make sure I understand your argument correctly, which is not a good thing you want to hear from any number of justices. And it looked like, and I think I came on the show and said, it didn't look like they had the appetite to undermine Section 230 on these on these claims.
One of the things that the plaintiffs were arguing against Google was they use algorithms.
Right. The idea was, well, to the extent that we think this is what they were litigating.
Terrorist content through algorithms, and that made them publishers. That made them complicit in the appearance of these videos on
So
YouTube.
Section 230 protects a platform for content created by others, to briefly paraphrase it, but it doesn't protect you from the stuff you create yourself.
So if you're a publisher, if I publish, you know, if Elon Musk publishes a tweet, that's different than if I publish a tweet, because he's Twitter.
Right. He's liable for his own stuff that he publishes, but he's not right for the third party who used his platform to publish it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, then you can litigate over, well, and what this case was litigating over, well, technically who created it. And so the plaintiff's argument, basically, although it was not well pled, was if you algorithmically promote something that somebody else
now
created,
you're publishing it.
Now you count as the creator,
or
and Section 230 doesn't count.
If you create a thumbnail.
Well, and if they wanted to gut 230, this was really
I was listening to the oral arguments, and poor Lisa, I was going, they don't create the thumbnail.
I was sitting next to the press pool, and a woman was sitting in the press pool who was like new to these issues, and I could hear her under her breath being like, but that's the whole argument and stuff like that. Like,
oh,
everybody
Lord.
Was screaming at it.
So what's interesting is, and it was Justice Thomas who wrote this opinion, he actually said, no, algorithm is everywhere. It's not publishing.
Well, so that was in the Tamna case. So with the Google versus Garcia, they basically punted it because they basically looked at it and
said
this
is weak. Tamna.
But they hung their hat on Tamna. So Tamna wasn't really dealing with Section 230 altogether.
Oh, this is interesting. Do you think they did that so they wouldn't, that this wouldn't apply to 230?
We are really baffled because this is why we think it's the best case scenario, because it's getting really hard to litigate 230 since so many people don't like it or misunderstand it. What he ended up saying was basically like, look, if you had no 230, would there be a claim anyway? Because essentially it's a concept of secondary liability.
It's aiding and abetting. Is it aiding and abetting?
Is it aiding and abetting? And the secondary liability is basically like, you know, if you do something, you're responsible for it. But am I somehow responsible for the thing you did when you're the one who did it?
Did I aid and abet you somehow?
Yeah, or this is your show, so it would be the other way around.
Right,
so like,
right.
Are you liable for something I say right now because it's your show?
Mike Masnick says that in his opinion, Justice Thomas gave the best argument in favor of 230 without mentioning 230.
Right, because basically 230 basically doesn't really change that. But if there's no secondary liability, then there'd be no liability anyway. Maybe that didn't come out clear, but basically there would be no cause of action.
Right.
You because you couldn't have been liable in the first place because you weren't the actor. It's not being pled that you were the actor. It's being pled that somehow there's a cause of action against you for secondary liability for something somebody else did. And he said this statute doesn't reach that because that's not what aiding and abetting could possibly mean. In which case, you still need Section 230 because it helps dispense with the litigation early.
Yeah.
But actually, it kind of looks like with this, on a regular motion to dismiss, you could actually get rid of it because there's no cause of action for aiding and abetting for something that ISIS happens to use the platform for. And the language that Thomas used to talk about the algorithms and as infrastructure is that, you know, without something a lot more than but just a platform being a platform is not enough
to create secondary
liability.
The fact that Twitter exists and that these tweets were on Twitter, it does not mean Twitter aided and abetted these terrorists.
Yeah, he's kind of like, maybe there's some hypothetical things out there, but you got to plead an awful lot more before you can start construing that the way tort liability works, that you could have culpability on somebody who was not the direct actor.
So this was the correct decision.
I think it was a very good decision. We all agree about it. And 9-0, so we don't have to worry about that. It was a Thomas decision.
It was very clear. But because it doesn't really mention 230... does it help strengthen 230?
It does in a way, and I think this is something that Masnick is getting to.
It doesn't weaken it.
What it kind of says is, you know, well, all right, so we talked about Senator Blumenthal before. He's since tweeted since the courts aren't going to give us a relief, we have to go to Congress.
Oh,
but basically,
great. So
it, in some sense, it pokes the hive of people who hate Section 230 because they didn't the court didn't blow it up for them. But what it basically did is it kind of painted the picture of like why we don't have the liability, like not as a Section 230 doing the internet as a favor, but just as a matter of law, as it's been for hundreds of years, we don't have liability that works like this. And I was reading it today and I almost think that, you know, Mike's piece is where he summarizes is good. I think it's even better than Mike says, because Mike's thinking about it in the Section 230 context. I'm thinking about it as American law does not bend like this, and it shouldn't bend like this, because this whole idea of what we've been developing to of my brother's keeper, that like third parties are responsible for something somebody else does, we traditionally have allowed it, but only in narrow circumstances, because it doesn't feel fair to be responsible for something somebody else did. And this was a big pushback on that trend in the law, to say, you know, the direct actor, totally liable. But non-direct actors, you've got to be really careful. And that's the way the law has always been.
And this was a somewhat scholarly, I got the impression, somewhat scholarly opinion.
It was nice. I mean,
Thomas looked at what aiding and abetting means in common law and so forth, and really said the right things and did the right thing.
There might be some credible criticism, but at first blanche reading it was, I am going to enjoy using that decision in my advocacy.
Good. So good news.
Good news. Surprisingly good news.
And it doesn't matter that they punted Google.
No, I mean, I think it had to happen, and it was probably just as well for everybody.
It was badly argued. The plaintiffs argued it.
The court couldn't blow up 230 on that particular case, but I think what Mike's point is that the Tamna case, basically, because then they used the Tamna case to say that that's what they used to get rid of the Google case, to say that, you know, even if they had pled correctly, you still wouldn't have had any underlying liability here. So the internet survived, and that's why we can have all of our nice social media platforms now.
All right. Thank you. This is Kathy. You wrote the brief for Google versus Gonzalez versus Google.
I wrote one there, and I also wrote an amicus brief, as I said, in the Warhol case, which they didn't read that one.
But. Yeah. But I imagine you made somewhat of the same 230 arguments in Gonzalez versus Google, yes?
Oh, my typical ones of it's good. And one of the signatories on it was an individual who hosts his own Mastodon server. Because if he's going to do that for his friends, where you can see the expressive rights and stuff, 230 works for him. Yeah. And I really wanted to make sure that people understood that 230 is not just for big companies, that it's the boots on the ground to make sure, especially if you don't like the big companies and that you have choices, that you need 230 to make sure other people out there can create those choices.
It was my point exactly, because as somebody else who runs a Mastodon server and a IRC and a Discord chat, you know, it's the little people who could really, I mean, I can't afford to defend myself.
Right.
230 protects us.
Yep, it does.
Google can afford to defend itself. It did, all the way to the Supreme Court.
Yep.
Twitter, all the way to the Supreme Court.
I'm not quite sure they paid those lawyers at the end. I'm really curious to know.
But I believe me, I couldn't. And so that is really important. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a forum. We wouldn't have an IRC. We wouldn't have a Mastodon because it would be too risky.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good thing.
Whew. Yep.
That was close.
Oh, it totally was. I'm having a weird weekend because I'm very happy and very unhappy. But the very happy part is... we can breathe a little bit.
Yeah. Fair use lost, Section 231.
Yeah.
That's the just skip the whole last half hour. That's all you need to know, right? Now you know why.
Fair use lost, the internet won.
Yeah.
To the extent that it doesn't rely on fair use. Good luck with that.
Oh, God. No, Kathy! we're going to take a little break. We have more to talk about. Our show today brought to you by Duo. I know. You must know the name Duo. I know the name Duo for a long time. We've used Duo to protect against breaches with a leading access management suite. Strong multi-layered defenses, innovative capabilities only allow legitimate users in to your network or your site or your app and keep bad actors out. For any organization concerned about being breached that needs protection fast, Duo quickly enables strong security while also improving user productivity. So many companies use Duo for that very reason. It's kind of a no-brainer. You just turn it on and you're safe. Duo prevents unauthorized access with multi-layered defenses and modern capabilities that thwart sophisticated malicious access attempts. We did a panel with Wendy Nather, who was a CISO at Duo. And, you know, I was so impressed by her and the Duo team. They're so smart. They know what they're doing. This is a rock solid solution that increases authentication requirements in real time as the risk rises. Isn't that awesome? So if things are getting problematic, Duo turns it on, turns it up to high. Duo enables high productivity by only requiring authentication when needed. See, it's just in time authentication, which means you get swift, easy, and secure access when it's safe, and they step up the requirements when it's not. Duo provides an all-in-one solution for strong MFA, passwordless, single sign-on, and trusted endpoint verification. I think we all know this is very important now. Duo helps you implement zero-trust principles by verifying users and their devices before they can touch your assets. Start your free trial. Sign up today. Signup.duo.com. This is their first ad. We're really thrilled to have them on Twit. I've been a Duo fan for years. Signup.duo.com. Duo, D-U-O, Duo. Signup.duo.com. Thank you, Duo, for all you do. We really appreciate it. And thank you, Twit listeners, for using that special address so they know you saw it here, right? Right. Google did reach a privacy settlement with Washington State. This is, you know, to me, this is just the tip of the iceberg. You may remember Google had settings to turn off their location tracking. Oh, but look, it didn't do anything. They still track you. And the state of Washington sued, saying Alphabet, well, Google's division of Alphabet, misled customers about its location tracking. The settlement resolves claims that Google deceived people into believing. You see, you foolish person, you believed you were controlling how Google collects and uses your personal data. They even gave you a switch, but it didn't do anything. A consent decree filed on Wednesday requires Google to be more transparent about its tracking practices and provide a more detailed location technologies web page describing them, and fines Google $39.9 million, which is like the interest on one day revenue. I mean, it's not. Is this enough? How important is this? I wonder why it's only Washington State. Arizona got an $85 million settlement with Google also. Feels like this should be something the feds should be.
Yet another place where the states are doing stuff that
the might hard be work.
Better done on the federal level.
Yeah. I'm surprised. I guess Lena Khan's worried about other stuff, but I'm surprised the FTC didn't weigh in on this one as well. But that's a good thing.
Yeah, and $39.9 million. Who cares?
It's the cost of doing business for Google, right? Interesting article in TechCrunch. I've heard of them, Amanda. This is your colleague.
I think I know them, right?
Yeah, I think I know who they are. It's on your check, I think. Your colleague, Adam.
Actually, on my checks is Yahoo. But
oh,
yes.
God. That's right. I forgot. Yeah, a Yahoo company. Adam Kovacevic. I hope I'm saying his name right. Kovacevic. Adam K, we call him. The government can't seize your data, but it can buy it. Similar story. The Biden administration proposed new protections earlier this month to prevent law enforcement from demanding reproductive health care data from companies like Twitter and Google. But they don't really need to because data brokers have that information. And the U.S. government has been buying that data from private data brokers for years. In fact, we reported, I think, last week about a data broker that won its case. What was the name of it? Kovacevic or something like that. The appeals court held that the government hadn't really shown harm. Oh, well, there's no harm in selling your location data. But the court, I guess, implied that, well, if you come back, FTC, with some people who've been harmed by this, well, then we can talk. Certainly a big issue in privacy. I think we need a law regulating data brokers, frankly.
It's such a shadowy business.
Yeah. They're out there. They're collecting that data, and then they just sell it to whoever wants it. That's why a ban against TikTok seems so silly, because TikTok isn't the problem. The Chinese government can just go to these data brokers and get anything they want about anybody they want.
It's not defining problems that you're throwing legislation at, which really needs to stop, because it's going to break more things and isn't going to fix anything.
Thank you.
Good article you wrote, I thought, Harry, I don't know if you heard it yet or not, about Apple's announced new voice feature. This will be in the fall, right, with iOS 17.
Later this year. And later this year. Presumably when the new OS updates come out, maybe.
But really cool. If you have ALS and as it progresses, it gets harder and harder to talk, people like Stephen Hawking start using machines that talk for them. Hawking quite famously. Now Apple is going to allow you to bank your voice. So if you have early stages ALS, you could bank your voice for the time when you'd have to use a speech machine, and it would sound like you.
It comes pretty close from the samples I heard.
Have you heard it?
Yes, I've heard a few samples. They don't sound 100% like that person might. They have a little bit of the typical stuff you associate with a synthesized voice, but they don't sound like Siri or Alexa or the Google Assistant. They sound like a specific human being, which is, to a lot of these people who might face this, really important. They would much rather express themselves with their own voice. And that was the goal here. And there have been ways to do this for a long time, but historically it could involve like a lot of training, which if you have ALS becomes even more of a challenge. It used to be quite expensive. It's gotten cheaper. But what Apple is doing is the next step in terms of making it completely accessible, because it will be available as on this device, which a lot of people have. And people will be able to do the voice banking on an iPhone, an iPad, or a Mac.
I don't know. I presume Apple's doing this internally. There are companies that do this already. I played with something from a company called Acapella, yes. And I had to read 215 phrases. Took me about half an hour, and then it made my voice. And now I don't have ALS, but if I ever needed, but it's kind of cool anyway. This is an example of my voice. Let's see. Make sure you have my sound, right? This is my voice. Oh, it's not coming out of the doohickey. Let me play it again.
Harry, can you get me a can of soda?
This kind of sounds like me.
From what I've heard of Apple's,
it's better.
If you did this with Apple's version, it would sound quite a bit more like you. Apple's takes 15 minutes of training, by the way. So
a lot faster. Yeah, I am not surprised.
So you need to package that up so you can be the voice that people can put on their car directions.
Yeah, actually, I did that back in the day. Tom was it TomTom? I think TomTom allowed you to record your voice. And now, actually, I have a Waze voice. It's me. In fact, I hadn't used Waze in a while.
I think this needs to be a Twit TV subscription benefit.
I could put it in the Club Twit. I hadn't used Waze in a while. I recorded this maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And we were worried about traffic, so I turned on Waze, and it said, turn left at the next, and it was me. And I said, that sounds like me, Lisa. And she said, it is you, you nitwit.
Speaking of that sort of thing, I've heard some people who have been concerned that Apple's technology could be used for nefarious purposes.
Could it?
Such as stealing somebody else's voice.
Yes.
And I think they have done a lot of thinking about that, and there are a bunch of existing services, which even though Apple's is not available yet now, people are already using for questionable purposes. With Apple's, the person who wants to do this has to do the training using these random
Is it on
phrases.
Your phone? Does it stay on the phone?
And in fact, you can just leave it on the phone if you want, and it never gets uploaded to the cloud at all. I mean, probably the single most interesting thing Apple has done technologically is they've crunched this down into a form where the crunching of your voice can be done on the device. You can upload it to iCloud, which you probably would want to do, because when you're doing this, it would be for later use, possibly using devices you don't own yet. But even on iCloud, it's encrypted, and I think it does seem like it would be tough for somebody to essentially steal your voice using this technology. It really does seem like it's under the control of the person who is banking their voice
using Apple stuff. Because you have to read specific phrases, they're random. So you couldn't take all the recordings of me, for instance, and do this.
You couldn't do that. It seems like it would be extremely difficult to impossible to like record Leo's voice and then train it and create a Leo voice without Leo being aware you were doing that.
Right.
Which is certainly a reasonable thing to be concerned about with some of these technologies.
There are AI companies. 11 Labs is one that we'll do this from arbitrary samples.
Yes.
But in order for us to do this, Anthony had to come in and have me read a statement that said, I am Leo Laporte and I give permission for this to be done. But now he's got my voice and he's doing all sorts of stuff with, I think our promos have my synthesized voice.
That was Descripts.
Oh, that was who?
Descripts.
Descripts. Does 11AI ask? No, 11AI says, just give me some samples.
Well, yeah, I mean, they say, like, you assume responsibility for, like...
It's all on you if something goes wrong. But any bad actor could then make my voice, right?
Yeah.
See, I worry. I guess I shouldn't. I've told, though, as a result, all my family and friends, we need a secret word. If I call you saying I've been kidnapped, please send $1 million ransom to this address. I need to have the secret word.
That's stuff like that is already happening. Based on technology.
Larry Maggot almost got suckered by somebody pretending to be his wife. He wrote the story on his website. I feel very nervous. And anybody who's in the public domain where they're, or and for some reason or other, even you guys, just because you're on this show, there's enough samples of your voices now. Sorry. Tell your loved ones.
I should have a lot more fame and fortune as a consequence of this for the amount of risk exposure.
I agree. We're going to have to start paying people a lot more to come on the show.
Yeah. You know, the problem with journalism is
you're in the public eye, but you make no money. Yeah. I've said that for a long time. Yeah, it's not good. So CNET is unionizing, by the way, because of Red Ventures using AI to write their articles. Has this been an issue at TechCrunch at all, Amanda?
No, we're not using generative AI in our articles, but. I think this was like a really interesting story. I actually think that CNET was starting to unionize before all the AI stuff happened, but I think there's a really clear connection between this and then like the WGA writer's strike in Hollywood, where in that strike, basically, AI wasn't really at the forefront, but they just kind of threw in something being like, hey, by the way, we don't want you to like replace us with AI or ask us to edit scripts that were written with AI and whatnot, which is also a legal issue, which we want to get more into that.
There was concern, for instance, how many years? It's 30 years of Simpsons episodes, that if you fed all of those scripts into an AI, could it write a credible Simpsons episode? Writers were very concerned.
I think
about
it can write something that looks like a Simpsons episode, but I don't think it's going to be good.
Yeah,
like,
we saw the Seinfeld that was horrible.
I wrote about the Nothing Forever. That was what it was called. But
Nothing Forever.
Yeah, I mean, it was literally just like Jerry Seinfeld being like,
"It's random.
There's a new restaurant," and then Elaine being like, "What kind of restaurant is it?" Which it is the show about nothing, but like. This was really the show about nothing. For those who don't know, we're talking about there was a Twitch phenomenon where it was like a generative AI Seinfeld animated copy that just went on forever. But
it got shut down because it eventually,
really,
as all AI does, became racist, right? That's kind of what always happens. Twitch ended up taking it down.
what happened with them was I think they were using...
Oh, it's transphobic.
A version of OpenAI.
Yeah.
Yeah, or like they were using a version of like the OpenAI software that had like gates to prevent it from saying things that could be offensive. But then I think that broke and their failsafe was to use like a non-gated version of that. And then Jerry in a stand-up set just, you know... went and had to say transphobic
this
things.
This is Nothing Forever. An infinitely generated...
Oh, sorry, it's somebody else talking over it. I wanted to play a little bit of it, but Motherboard's got a narration on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we can't play it anymore. They're gone.
Yeah.
Wisely so. I'm going to say something.
I think they're actually back on Twitch now.
Oh, are they? Oh, boy. Yeah, because they were only banned for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But then I thought they got the good common sense to just, like, this isn't worth fighting over.
I don't know. I was subscribed to them when I was writing about them, but I haven't like looked at it in a while, but I'm still getting the emails like they're live on Twitch, and then I just haven't checked in, but maybe I need to see what they're up to.
Yeah, let's see. Do they have any shows scheduled? No, no shows. It's not the right channel? Oh, okay. Well,
it's like Watch Me Forever is their URL.
Watch Me Forever, not Nothing Forever. Okay. They're called...
Well, Nothing Forever is the name of the show, but then yeah. Watch Me Forever is the channel.
It's very confusing.
Inconsistent branding.
That's a problem. Oh, yeah, I've been to Watch Me Forever because it immediately... Oh, it looks like it's still doing it. There's an ad on it right now.
Yeah.
Well, very interesting. I am a contrarian on AI, by the way. I don't know. I'll let you guys yell at me for this. But I say my thought is computers are not intelligent. They do not think. They never have. And they never will. They're just a box of rocks that calculates so fast it appears to be thinking. We don't have to worry about AI becoming dangerous because it's not intelligent. It's just stupid words that it's stringing together. It doesn't even know what it's saying, and it is harmless. It's just and people, especially the media, are playing it up as if it's going to be the next, you know, oh God, it's the Terminator, it's Skynet, and it's not. It's never going to be because it doesn't think.
I agree. The problem is the people deploying it are also kind of stupid, and they're going to deploy it in some really dumb ways because they think it does more than it actually does.
Well, that is a risk because it's often wrong.
Yeah. Right. Well, I think that's. Yeah. I think you're absolutely right on what it is and what its limitations are. It doesn't mean that there's not some externalities we shouldn't be alarmed at, but I think, again, it's like there's the policy panic of people are getting alarmed at the wrong things because they don't understand it. They're gunning after it as if it's this magic that needs to be boxed up, but that's not the problem.
I'll go another step because, of course, Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, testified in front of Congress and said, yes, you should regulate us, and it's my opinion that all of these people who are building up the danger, including Sam Altman of AI, yes, we need to be regulated. This is them pretending that what they're doing is somehow intelligent. And, oh, we better watch out. It's self-serving. They want you to think they're doing something more than they're doing.
It's just fancy software.
Altman knows very well it's not dangerous. It's not going to do anything. And it doesn't need to be regulated any more than Eliza needed to be regulated.
To bring it back to the CNET staff trying to unionize, I think like that's an example of Kathy's point about how it's not necessarily the technology, it's the people using it that are using it in questionable ways. But like CNET was trying to publish news articles written with ChatGPT, and then of course there were a bunch of inaccuracies.
They were crap. Yeah. They got bit by that, right?
Well, yeah, they were bad. They weren't true. Yeah. And but the fact that CNET even was like, this is a good idea, we're going to do this, is like people are using this stuff in ways that are so like, I'm more afraid of the people that are using
AI. Well, it's always the
AI.
People. Yeah.
And then, I mean, the same thing is also happening with the WGA strike, where like, yes, you could feasibly put in 30 years of Simpsons episodes and make a Simpsons episode. But like, it's just going to be like Lisa plays clarinet skateboards.
It's going to be like that Seinfeld. It's not going to be good.
Yeah.
Are the writers...
But that doesn't mean that like... I mean, but yet still, like,
people
that was
do,
in the contract
right.
that the screenwriters were
right.
trying to like protect themselves with. And then the studios were like, no, we're not going to commit to not using generative AI.
Well, and to make your point, CNET fired a bunch of writers because presumably Red Ventures thought, well, why are we paying humans to write this crap?
I think BuzzFeed did too.
Yeah. BuzzFeed News went out of business.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And Vice has declared bankruptcy. So I understand they might want to use AI, but this isn't a path to success. You need people like Harry to write this stuff.
On the other hand, Leo, I'm not going to tell you you're wrong about this, but I sometimes lately have wondered if I'm just a box of rocks that's good at stringing together words, and maybe that's true of all of us. And
that's an interesting question.
Certainly, this technology is going to get at least somewhat better in the years to come.
If it continues
at the same pace it has over the last 6 months, it may get much better, much more quickly. And
I have a, here's my thing. I have a, maybe this is what I'm really saying. I have a belief that no matter how fast it gets, how much better it gets, it will never equal you. Because I think there is something different about you than a box of rocks doing very fast calculations.
I mean, the best journalism, that's certainly true. I can do things like...
Look at self-driving cars. Right. They got better and better and better, but they still run over kids. Right. And they will never not run over kids.
But so do humans, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I can score interviews with interesting people. I think humans still have interesting takes on things that a computer can't replicate. But I think that it just raises the bar for journalists. I mean, there's an enormous amount of content out there.
That's crap.
Generated by humans, it's terrible.
Yeah.
And that stuff is going to be in trouble.
That's what's in trouble. I think the same thing about artists.
The very best stuff's generated by humans. I think there's still going to be a market for, but it scares me a little bit because if all you're doing is putting up a post about what time the Super Bowl is on,
right?
A computer can do that in 15 seconds.
A human should not be doing that.
At least as well as a human can or better. So maybe in that way, it's encouraging that the people who are actually doing good stuff have a future, and the people who are completely cynical and just trying to monetize stuff through clicks might be in trouble.
I saw a skeet, I think, the other day who said something like, I didn't think that the robots would be doing all the art and the humans doing the low-wage, terrible work instead, or something like, this was not the future I was hoping for.
But I think that's upside down. I think the robots will be doing all the low-wage, stupid.
It makes more sense ultimately, because I think your point is hopefully correct, which is that humans bring a certain je ne sais quoi that really fancy good software is just not going to be able to replicate. Yeah. And at some point, the human beings will come to appreciate that appropriately, designate the grunt work to the robots, and keep the cool human stuff for the humans.
I actually found a piece of grunt work, which I'm going to happily turn over to ChatGPT, which is when we do a post on Fast Company, there's this SEO field where you have to write like a short piece summary.
Should be great.
Summary. Yes. And actually, the goal of the short summary is to be as boring as possible, but to be stuffed with the relevant
keywords.
That's
a machine talking to a machine.
ChatGPT can do that super quickly.
Yeah.
If I don't have to, it can do it better than I can. And if I'm not doing it, I can spend more time actually doing stuff that human beings will see and hopefully appreciate. Yeah.
Machine, it makes sense. Machines should do the writing aimed at machines.
And in fact, probably at some point, that should just be like, Not even a field, but something which our publishing system does automatically.
We're looking at that. We want to use
all the way down.
Yeah, we want to use AI to do transcripts, do summaries, do maybe
chapter markings. Not Supreme Court analysis.
Huh?
Not Supreme Court analysis.
What's that mean?
Oh.
It'll be like Leo and three bots at some point during the show.
Well, that wouldn't be so bad. Oh, never mind. Sorry I said that, Benito.
But even still with transcripts, like, I often am using Otter AI. This is not sponsored.
No, I like Otter.
To, like, record interviews. Yeah. And it's really, really helpful, and it is a lot faster than if I were hand transcribing, but it's still not perfect.
Right. My contention is that you can get 90% of the way. It's that last 10% that is impossible. We've seen this again and again in technology, and that's what humans can do. And I don't. I'm not mystical. I don't think that, you know, they'll never have a soul.
I think people are alarmed that the acceleration of the technology is happening quickly in terms of improvements. So people are sort of panicking at the upshot, both the potential and the upshots.
Yes.
And that panic is, we have more time to sort of figure out how to deal with this, but we don't necessarily have as much time as we thought like 5 years ago. And given that there's a number of people who are like, this cool thing I'm going to deploy in a really sort of socially destructive way is not helping dial down the panic.
I think it's a mistake, though, to extrapolate, okay, look how fast it's growing. Just guess where it's, doesn't mean it's going to suddenly be Einstein.
No, but I think we're having a visceral emotional reaction to it as opposed to a clear-headed, cogent assessment of risk and balance and rewards and stuff like that, which, welcome to tech policy, that's the way it always is.
And there is legitimate concern in the area of disinformation because you can create disinformation at speed now. And so, we've got an election coming up in 2024, and the zone's going to be flooded with crap. It's really good at creating bad crap. You don't need a bunch of Russians in a Russian troll farm to do that anymore. You can just do it with machines.
And ChatGPT can write English a lot more clearly than your Russian troll can probably.
Yeah, it'll be grammatical. Grammatical crap.
Yeah, I feel like this is one of those issues in tech where I feel like the most clear answer I can think of is that I just think I want people to be really conscious consumers and think about where what they're reading is coming from and what the motivation is. But like, I really want to say that we should be able to trust humanity, but it's hard to know if that's true.
Well, let's teach all the kids critical thinking skills. Oh, but not without books or social media or take away the internet. But we'll totally have the next generation ready to like think these things through carefully.
Well, then it makes you wonder, why do they want to take that stuff away, right?
Because they might actually have critical thinking skills and have some dubious responses to some of the policy getting rammed down their throats.
I'm getting very depressed.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, the good news is we don't have to take it.
Yeah.
I guess it makes me angry because I'll go, especially it's really bad on Twitter. All the Bitcoin bros have been replaced now by AI bros. 15 great things you can do with ChatGPT, 12 ways to make money with ChatGPT. And I think the only people making money are the people who are selling these great ideas to suckers. I think maybe we've oversold the potential of AI. Yeah, the
risk. Also fascinating is just in terms of like the cyclicalness of trends in tech. I do think that there is much, much more to AI than crypto. However, it is really interesting that 2 years ago, I'm sure that this, like the podcast was all about like what's happening with ETH. And then now in our little document here, I don't think there's a single crypto story.
No ETH stories.
Nope.
And who knows where we'll be in
2 years. But also AI has been powering so much tech for so long. It's just that now with generative AI in particular, it's much more obvious and people are using ChatGPT just like to play around with it and then seeing what this tech is capable of.
I mean, there's certain topics that I just tune out. So I skip the metaverse. I skip the Bitcoin stuff. And I'm generally skipping the AI, but I'm going to get sucked back into it because AI is raising a couple of issues, some of which is the application of it, but the other is the inputting and the training. And that keeps ending up hitting the copyright space hard. Partly because there's an intersection between the two, but I'm a little bit more alarmed because the people who say, no, you shouldn't be able to train your AI on a population of words, I think impacts the right to read. And what does get me worried is everybody else who's impacting the right to read, that we're going to take away the books, we're going to take away the social media. And I think we need to have a bigger reckoning of that is an important First Amendment right, and it's an important right for a reason. And I think we lock things up away from... It's not good to lock the words up from people, but I also think it's a problem if you lock things up so people can't send their assistant to go read the books for them or their robotic assistant to go read the books for them. And I think people need to think through what they're asking for, especially as a solution for, I think we have genuine problems in how we apply it, but that doesn't mean we should forbid the training because the training implicates completely different policy issues.
Once in a while, I will intentionally use these chatbots to try to get them to talk about stuff that I've written about to see if I can see what I've written in them. And I'd say most of the time, even if they are kind of reflecting something I did, it's not in a way that I find disturbing or think should be illegal. I did see one of them, I think Bard the other day, which they did the kind of thing that if it was a human doing it, you would say that they were either a plagiarist or flirting with plagiarism because there really were entire blocks of my wording in there with no attribution. And so it'll be interesting to see. I mean, if that kind of stuff I'm not crazy about, but it's quite different if me and a dozen other people who wrote about something all get mishmashed together and something gets spat out on the other side that might not exist in exactly the same way if I hadn't written my piece.
That's a creative
process.
But
it's not entirely dependent on my own personal wording, at least with attribution if you're going to use whole blocks of what I wrote.
I'm worried that we're accidentally banning web crawlers.
Yeah, totally. I mean, this is the new web crawling. Mm-hmm. And people used to think web crawling it was sketchy.
I think it's also really interesting the difference between how we see generative AI with text versus with images, because I think it's a lot less obvious in generating a text block to see like where it is drawing very specific phrases and ideas directly from writers. Whereas with art, you can say, do this in the style of Van Gogh, And it's very clearly like, yep, those are those very particular kinds of brush strokes and whatnot. Or like, it feels a lot more obvious with visual art. And I don't know what that really, what are the implications of that? But I find it interesting.
There, you see it all the time on Twitter among these new AI bros, the notion that in 5 years, films will be made by AI, not filmmakers and not actors and not writers.
I just don't think people want that, though.
No, I don't want that. That's for sure. I don't
like,
want
that's,
that.
I mean, I'm worried about people, like, for people making illustrations for, like, book covers or something. It's like, yeah, you can probably ask an AI to make, like,
crappy art.
A picture of a bat that's turning into a woman. I don't know what book that is, but there's an idea. But, but like, for actual creative works, like, I don't want to see a film that an AI made. And I think there's a gimmicky interest in it. But historically in art, these gimmicky interests are only temporary. And I think right now we are in the moment where people think it's fun. If maybe there was a film made with AI, it would be like, oh, this is interesting. But then when there's a second movie made using AI, no one will think it's interesting anymore.
I'm not even crazy about movies that are mostly CGI built.
Yeah.
And I think with one of the Star Wars, I think the Last Jedi, they made a point to say we did our special effects by going back to modeling.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, there's something about that where they were like, we didn't want it to be just so computery. We wanted it to actually be the old school things where there was some physical tangibility that still showed through onto the print that people were watching.
How long have we been trying to fight the uncanny valley with computer animation? And yet, I don't think we've yet done computer animation that really is like human, right? Or have we? Maybe I don't. Maybe we haven't. I don't know yet.
It's shrunk, but it has not disappeared.
Have you used Horizon Worlds?
But no legs is the giveaway, right? That's the key. All right, so I have asked Midjourney, Amanda, to give me an image of a bat that is turning into a woman. And actually, it's doing a pretty good job here. Which one do you like? One, two, three, or four?
I think four is interesting, but I'm also seeing it like this big on my screen.
Yeah, so, well, I'm gonna upscale it. I'm gonna make it look a little bit bigger so you can see it. There it is.
Ooh,
how do you like that?
Yeah, see, that's pretty cool.
That ain't bad.
Kind of Elizabethan.
It's an Elizabethan bat turning into a woman.
That's Victorian.
Oh,
yeah,
right.
Now we just have to use ChatGPT to write a story about a bat turning into a woman. And
I could do it. You don't need ChatGPT. I could make it up.
No, exactly.
Well, why bother when ChatGPT could do it? I like this one myself.
ChatGPT, it'll just be like, there once was a bat, and then suddenly it gained consciousness, and now it's a woman, and it has to figure out how to be a person instead of a
All
bat.
Right. You, I'm going to, this is your assignment, Harry. You do it with Bard. I'll do it with ChatGPT. Okay. All right. What will the prompt be? Let's see. Tell me a story. In what style should the story be? Do we want it Shakespearean? Do we want it Dickensian?
I'm going to try to think of one with my brain that isn't the obvious.
I'm going to try to think of a
brain. Okay, you
one
two do humans. I'm going to use ChatGPT-4. Tell
that turning into a
me
woman.
A story in the style of Dickens about a bat turning into a woman, right?
Okay.
Now, well, I have to point out that I'm using ChatGPT-4, you're using Bard, and then we have two humans. Here's what ChatGPT-4 said. In the crowded, bustling heart of London, far removed from the genteel squares and manicured parks of its aristocratic corners, there existed a unique feature, a sight unseen in such a urban sprawl. It was an old, gnarled oak. Wow, we didn't even mention an oak. Relic of ancient woods long since razed to the ground. Within the hollow of this time-ravaged tree nestled an inky creature of the night, a bat named Myrtle. Myrtle was no ordinary bat. Her eyes held a human-like glint. Her movements were purposeful and intelligent, and she was inexplicably drawn to the city's glow, especially to its vibrant pulse of humanity. Her fascination for the world of men was so intense that it bordered on obsession, obsession that would trigger a metamorphosis of a most fantastical sort. One fateful night, a storm of biblical proportion raged. This is actually not bad. Come on, what do you got, Harry?
I feel like maybe you should read it just so we have the same flavor.
But all right, I'll read it. Give it to me here.
It starts with the biggest cliche in the book.
Sure. Here's a story in the style of Dickens about a bat turning into a woman. It was a dark and stormy night. So that's it. A wind howled and the rain beat against the windows of the old house. Inside, a young woman sat by the fire reading a book. She was alone and she was scared. Suddenly, there was a loud crash. The young woman jumped up and ran to the window. She saw a bat flying through the storm. The bat flew into the house and landed on the mantelpiece. The young woman was terrified. She'd never seen a bat before. She didn't know what to do. The bat looked at the young woman with its big, dark eyes. The young woman felt a strange sensation. She felt like she was being drawn to the bat. Oh, it goes on. I'm actually more engaged by this story. Hmm. It's not as well written, though, especially the darkest.
And eventually you learn that this bat was also a woman.
Oh.
That's kind of the kicker rather than the...
By the way, my story ends, over many months, Myrtle, now known as Miriam, listened to Miss Havisham's stories, her tales of lost love and long-dead dreams. Wow. Even as Miriam, she retained the curious, observant nature of her bat self, but now had the power to engage, to influence, to help. She understood the loneliness of human hearts, the shared plight of all beings, whether they soared in the sky or walked. I think ChatGPT-4 wins.
This has a similar conclusion, and in general with these
things.
They
always have happy endings.
They often end by talking about how great something is. And if you ask them about a tech journalist, any tech journalist, they will say, this person is incredible and well-known and beloved.
Oh, shoot. I thought that was only me.
Sorry, Leo.
I'm so disappointed.
It is interesting that you chose Charles Dickens for this experiment because, according to my Google search, is Dickens public domain? Apparently, a lot of the works of Dickens are in the public domain. So,
yes,
it does beg the question of how much of this is coming from the fact that ChatGPT probably is trained on like entire Dickens novels.
Oh, good point. All of that would be in there, wouldn't it? Yeah. By the way, it loves you, Harry, by the way. Just thinks you're the greatest.
Even just like the streets of London is very Dickens.
Yeah, but it probably is giving me credits for things I didn't write.
Please note, this information may be outdated as my training only includes data up to September 2021.
You can, if you have ChatGPT Plus, you can turn on the browsing feature, in which case it
adds more to it. Yeah, I haven't got the plugins yet.
All right, I wrote 4 paragraphs of fiction while you were
Let's hear what happens to Myrtle the Bat.
Oh, it's Myrtle the Bat?
No, it doesn't have to be Myrtle.
That would make sense, but I didn't name the bat. It had been such a nice castle, abandoned, spooky, and devoid of any humans whatsoever, until one day, suddenly, a ruckus came from down below. Peering down the old stone staircase, the bat saw boxes and suitcases being piled inside the door. It had at last happened. People had moved in.
Oh.
And the bat quickly realized they had moved into its house. What was it to do with its home invaded?
No.
The bat sighed and reached its reluctant conclusion. If you can't beat them, he said, join them. And so it flew off to the attic where the old potion jars were kept, knocked off the lid of one holding a bubbling blue solution, and dove in head first. As it gasped in pain, as the burn it felt like was boring into each of its cells, it knew that this was still the solution. This time tomorrow, I shall be a woman.
Dr. Jekyll and Ms. Bat. I like that. I like that. Amanda, you want to give it a shot or...
Yeah, so I was thinking more about, like, conceptually. I did not write anything down. I was riveted by your experiments with AI.
I think these all were very good, yeah.
Yeah, but my idea is turning this into a nonfiction essay project in which we explore tales from around the world from folklore in which women and animals are connected and women are turning into animals or vice versa. Ah. Or, for example, in the story of Circe from Greek mythology, she's turning men into animals, but she herself is not being turned into an animal. So, yeah, so I'm taking this and doing a nonfiction essay collection about portrayals of women.
You can sue all these AIs because you are the one who came up with a woman and turning into a bat. So you
oh, gosh, no.
And this is what Sam Altman thinks about all of this, CEO of Chat, or the folks who do ChatGPT, OpenAI. I don't know why Reuters decided to use this picture of Sam testifying before.
We don't have enough moral panicking.
He looks so scared. I'm scared. He actually, the pull quote is when they asked him if the artificial intelligence could interfere with election integrity, he says, I'm nervous about it. So there's a picture of Sam being nervous about it.
Please. Me too, Sam.
Regulate it. It's too good. It's scary. Let's take a little break. When we come back, final thoughts. You guys are, gosh, I don't know. I have to give a little credit to both Bard and ChatGPT for coming up with some interesting
stuff. Or the human who wrote four paragraphs of original fiction in 5 minutes.
Was amazing. Gosh, I don't know. They were all quite good.
Oh, good. I mean, compared favorably to ChatGPT.
You did a great job, Kathy, but we're going to go with the computer because it's cheaper.
I stand with WGA. Just happened to me.
But you have no chance of plagiarizing Dickens, so.
Yeah,
I would
right.
have if I had more time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's in the public domain, so I could totally do that.
Totally clear.
It just took a while to physically write the four
paragraphs. I actually was impressed with what you did.
Okay, thank
you. Too.
It was quite good. We should have a vote. Chat room, which story would you want to finish? Kathy, Bard, or ChatGPT? Which one?
I'm with Kathy.
Thank you, gosh, Amanda. Thank you.
Vote with the human. The human
or
got it right.
Or do they want to read my nonfiction book?
Our show today brought to you by Mint Mobile. We love Mint Mobile. Been using Mint Mobile for 2-3 years now. I can't remember. I got from Mint Mobile, I bought an iPhone SE. That was $15 a month. And then I got the $15 a month plan. Unlimited talk and text plus 5 gigabytes a month. It's actually been going up. It was 3 when I got it. It's now 5. They keep adding more data on the nation's number one 5G network, the largest 5G network in America. This is a great deal. Inflation's everywhere. Prices are going up, except at Mint Mobile. The only thing getting inflated at Mint Mobile is the number of gigabytes you can download. $15 a month. What's the secret? They don't have stores. They're the first company to sell premium wireless service online only. You save a ton. Plans start at $15 a month. You can bring your family, too. And by the way, families start at 2 people. So the family plan is a great deal, and they don't even, you know, they don't have to actually, just don't tell Ryan Reynolds, but they don't even have to be relatives. You could just, your family could be your friends, right? By going online only, eliminating the traditional costs of retail, Mint Mobile passes significant savings on to you. They don't even charge you for the SIM. And now they support eSIMs. So if you have a phone that supports eSIMs, it's even easier to switch to Mint Mobile. You could port your number over, happens very quickly. You can bring all your contacts and apps with you or get a phone from them. All plans, again, come with unlimited talk and text and high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Switch to Mint Mobile. Get premium wireless service starting at just $15 a month. And I know when I say that number, you probably gloss it over because you think, oh, there's going to be added fees and services. It's going to cost me $50, $60, $70. No, that's the other guys. Mint Mobile, $15 a month. That's it. 15, 1-5. How much are you paying for your wireless service? Maybe you ought to think about switching. Get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month and get the plan shipped to your door for free. Go to mintmobile.com/twit. Mintmobile.com/twit. They'll ship it right to your door. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month. That's for 5 gigabytes of data. That's all most people need, but you want more, they've got more. They even have an unlimited plan. $30. Mint Mobile, how much are you paying right now? 3 times that, at least, right? Mintmobile.com/twit. We thank them so much for supporting our show. And you support it when you go to that address, mintmobile.com/twit. We've got a little mini movie we made, narrated, by the way, by my AI voice on everything that happened this week on Twit. Watch. Pixel phones are gaining a new ringtone. Inspired by Kenny G.
Oh, my God.
I swear, you always know when it's Kenny G on the horn. Yeah.
Get ready for the name of this. This is the Kenny Jingtone.
Previously on Twit. Tech News Weekly.
Late yesterday, the news broke that Montana became the first state to officially ban TikTok.
One expert I talked to, I loved this analogy, compared it to legalizing flying. You can say now people can fly, but people aren't really built to fly.
This week in Google.
Wemo, okay. Don't ever buy their stuff, period. If I've ever shown you them, just say, Stacy, you are wrong. Here's the issue. One, it's actually not that there was a serious vulnerability, although it is very serious. And the researchers was like, this is terrible. We should tell Belk and Wemo. So they did. And Belk and Wemo said, they're not going to fix it.
Security now.
If an AirTag, set of AirPods, or Find My Network accessory is discovered to be unlawfully tracking a person, law enforcement can request any available information from Apple to support their investigation. No one appears to care about tag ownership tracking. But I suspect that not many people know or have stopped to wonder.
I got a hammer.
To start off with.
And I got an air tag. Screw that.
Oh!
I don't want anybody.
Twit.
You know that we know where your phones are, Leo, right?
It's a good point, actually. You know, they could track you about 100 ways to Sunday. The air tag is not the problem. Hope you enjoyed this week. And by the way, I did kill my AirTag, and that was that. I don't miss it.
Curl up with your metaverse headset.
Yeah. I could do that. Everything I'm wearing tracks me. It's not. I realize there's no point in worrying about your AirTag. Everyone knows where you are at all times. NASA has made good a boo-boo, at least a boo-boo according to Jeff Bezos. His space company, Blue Origin, is now going to be able to make a second human-crewed lunar lander. NASA chose SpaceX to make the first one, to which Jeff Bezos yelled and screamed and said it was a terrible thing. I think he might have even sued. But now the agency on Friday announced that there's a $3.4 billion contract coming your way, Jeff, to make a lunar lander for the upcoming Artemis mission to the moon. The Blue Origin lander will have one uncrewed demonstration mission ahead of a human crewed demo that's set to take place in, I thought this was going to be like next year, 2029, John. That's like forever. This is currently the plan is for four astronauts to fly to the, it is a Rube Goldberg device. They're going to fly to the Gateway Space Station on NASA's Space Launch System rocket and the Orion spacecraft. Then they're going to get out, get into the Blue Origin, and they're going to go on the Blue Origin for a week-long trip to the moon's south pole. So complicated. SpaceX won a sole contract in 2021. Blue Origin sued and lost over the decision in 2021. NASA announced in 2022, never mind, we're going to do a second one. So now they got two.
The 60th anniversary in 2029 of the original landing.
Wow. That means I'm the only person in this room who remembers it.
I thought I remembered it watching it in kindergarten.
In 1969?
Until somebody pointed out it didn't happen during the day and I would not have been at school in July.
But so, you're not old enough to remember it, are you?
Theoretically. Maybe.
You could have.
Maybe.
But you were a little kid.
I appear to have been remembering a later landing, at least.
Yeah, that counts. I remember getting up middle of the night. Well, it wasn't quite the middle of the night. It was like 4 a.m. or something in Rhode Island.
I had the Columbia launch originally in kindergarten. Oh. That was mine.
That's the one that...
Well it fell apart later. I was in kindergarten, I remember 9/11. So.
Yeah, okay.
Let's see. A D&D streaming TV channel is coming your way. Excited?
Mm-hmm. I love D&D, and I am so skeptical of what is going on with, like, Hasbro, who owns Wizards of the Coast, which owns D&D, trying to make D&D, like, a Lord of the Rings or a Harry Potter-type franchise, which this is literally, like, what Hasbro has said in communications with investors, that they're trying to make D&D, quote-unquote, a four-quadrant streaming or four quadrant media property or something. But it's just so weird because there's really not IP with D&D. Like, what makes D&D fun is what you're doing with your friends,
right?
When you're creating stories collaboratively with other people, like, that aren't property of D&D. And I don't know. I mean, I'm curious what's going to happen with this, but I'm also like, damn, they're just really trying to monetize this right now.
Well, you can't really blame them. Dungeons and Dragons. I think the part of it is because of the success of Encounter Party, right? They are huge. One of the top channels on YouTube and Twitch.
And yeah, I mean, there's actual play shows like Critical Role and Dimension 20 that are hugely successful.
Oh, Critical Role, like, that's who I was thinking of. They're really big, aren't they? They're on Twitch.
Yeah, yeah. When I think in like fall 2021, there was a Twitch data breach where someone published
how much money they made.
Like, in order, the most profitable channels. And Critical Role was making something like $90 million a year from Twitch alone.
90 million.
Fact check me on that, because this is like something I wrote 2 years ago that I'm remembering. But
you could lop off a lot of zeros and it would still be an issue.
Well, and I think one of the reasons Critical Role succeeds is because they're people. And you get into the people, right? You care about the people.
They're professional voice actors and improvisers.
Right.
And
they're funny.
What is D&D if not voice acting and improvising? And I don't know. You have activated my trap card, but I don't know. I mean, speaking of like the theme of like the legal issues of it all, like there was a whole controversy with D&D earlier this year where there's like a license that allows fans to make content like Critical Role or content even like, hey, I'm going to write a little module where you can have a pirate class or something instead of the existing fantasy classes.
So what's going on here? Now, this is the Dungeon Master, this guy here.
And then I believe so.
Are there teams? Like, there's two teams? Or there's...
No, I think those are just all the players.
They're
and they
have
them
players.
Staggered like
okay.
that for screen
Looks
size.
Looks like Hollywood Squares, yeah.
Yeah.
I can see why you'd watch this.
Looks more like the match game.
No, yeah, I mean, it's...
But you're not
like
watching the game.
Play.
You're just watching these people talk about it, right? There's no... It's not like League of Legends where there's something to watch.
No, I mean, like, the way that you play is, like, you're quite literally just, like, using the structure of
right.
these
it's
rules
creative.
That
yeah.
are now open source, that, like, you're just using these rules as a way of telling stories with your friends, and you're, like, improvising, like, at a table with people. Like, when I go to play D&D, like, I don't know what story I'm going to tell. That depends on, like, what the other people around me are doing.
Right.
And so it's, like, compelling in the same way that improv is compelling.
Right, right. Well, who knows? Maybe Hasbro has the secret sauce, and they're going to make this something very exciting. I have to say, there's real trouble ahead in the streaming world, but more importantly, in the cable world. Cord cutting has hit an all-time high, according to Variety. Pay TV subscriptions, their lowest levels since 1992. You look like a cord cutter, Kathy Kellis.
I got cord cutted when I moved because I couldn't have it where I moved to. But now I'm going to move to someplace where I could have it. But the pricing is like insane.
Yeah.
So at this point, I've sort of gotten used to not having the cord. But I mean, I think just retransmission fees are such an error.
The local stations.
Well, of everything. And yeah. then don't get me started on the copyright lawsuit that obliterated Locast, where now you can't rent an antenna.
Right.
I rip that to shreds in a TechDirt post, and I will start snarling again if I start talking about that case. But copyright law shouldn't do it, and it was bad for everybody because the public has access. These are public airwaves, and the public now does not have a reliable way of getting access to what is put on their own public spectrum. And this
the problem was when we allowed cable local TV channels to both charge you and run ads. They didn't want to give up either revenue stream. So the idea of ad-supported free over-the-air TV, nope, they didn't want to do that anymore. They wanted to make sure that you paid fees to them.
I still miss Locast.
I still
Locast
I miss
brilliant.
I can't participate in cultural events like a Super Bowl. I mean, I can't even watch the ads that advertisers are still paying money to have broadcast to audiences because now the audience has to pay for the privilege of watching the ad.
Pay TV penetration, in, like cable or DirecTV, is now down to 58% of U.S. households. Big declines for Comcast, for DirecTV, for Dish. Comcast dropped 614,000 customers in the first quarter alone.
I wouldn't, to your assumption, I wouldn't be a cord cutter except circumstances cut it, and now it just may be
now
too
you're happy.
Pricing.
You can't get in.
No, I'd like to come. I'd like to come back, but it's too prohibitively.
Well, even
expensive.
YouTube TV is like $73 for the base services, and that is because of the locals. By the way, I think that's.
I don't know. I guess in my like adult life, I think at first I was like, I'm not paying for cable. I'm like in a like low paid writing job. And then now I'm like, I could probably afford it, but I'm just used to not having it. And I'm like, do I really want to pay an extra $70 a month?
Your life is better without it.
Well, I don't pay a lot of streamers either. So like, I miss when I could sort of like have one easy budgetable price and get most of what I wanted. And now that reality doesn't really exist.
Right.
But I don't really want to pay. I mean, I think I'd rather pay cable than a whole bunch of streamers. But at this point, the streaming market is economically nonsensical anyway. So I just pay for like a couple things that like happen to mean more. And it's not worth dumping a whole lot of money into.
Have you seen Harry McCracken? Have you seen, speaking of streaming, the BlackBerry movie?
Saw it and used that as an excuse to write about how great BlackBerry was last week.
We were so addicted to it. This is Harry's article in Fast Company. The triumph. Yes, triumph of BlackBerry. BlackBerry's no longer doing a phone, but they do the operating system for many cars.
I mean, yeah, QNX is actually pretty cool. They just acquired it too late in the game for it to help them make a great phone.
Yeah. So the movie, which is based on the book Losing the Signal, it's out now, or is it about
to
come?
It is out.
It's out.
It's been out for a few weeks.
It's not a documentary, right? It's
No, it's in fact the first thing you see is a card explaining that it's a fictionalized version of what happened, and they really did not try super hard to be all that accurate, and it's in fact kind of cartoony.
The trailer's great. I really enjoyed the trailer. Oh, good. So this is one to see.
Well,
I had some issues
anywhere?
With that. I mean,
I don't know where it is.
I'm a tech journalist who writes about tech history, so I personally wanted something that was a little bit more accurate.
Right.
That said, I'd say it seems like most of the reviews have been positive, and film critics are not going to judge it on whether they detailed exactly what happened in the 1980s when Research in Motion was getting started. So it seems like, generally speaking, it has been a crowd pleaser.
I don't think people would want the truly geeky real story as much.
That would have been tough. And in fact, when I wrote about it, my point was kind of that the things that made BlackBerry great would not make for a great movie because it was stuff like the fact that they created
tactile keyboards.
Tactile keyboard, the fact that they had a server that prevented the network from coming down, the fact they cared about security. And in fact, the movie has a few moments where there are like meetings where they tried to of people discussing that. And those are the least riveting parts of the movie because they just don't make for a great drama, even though that they do help explain why this thing once upon a time really mattered.
It's been in theaters for 2 weeks, hit 1.7 million last weekend. We'll see what it does this weekend. That's its second weekend. This will be its third. The trailer was great. And anybody who lives, we all had BlackBerries, right?
I had a Palm.
I did.
Oh,
I was more of a Trio person for the most part, personally.
Yeah, I had a Trio. But right before the iPhone came out, my last phone before the smartphones was a BlackBerry Pearl. When did you have a BlackBerry, Amanda? You must have been in eighth grade.
No, like literally, I think I was in eighth grade. I think it was because like my dad had them for work. And then when he got a new one, then you'd that was just like the phone that I got.
Yeah.
So we both were very into Brick Breaker, the BlackBerry game.
Yep. I love
great
my BlackBerry.
Game.
I remember my kids saying, "Dad, put down the BlackBerry. Pay attention to us." So that's how I know. Hey, what fun it's been to get together with all of you. Thank you, Kathy Gellis, for your analysis of the Supreme Court stuff. Very complicated, but I think you cut through it and explained why it was important. It clearly was. I'm glad you wrote those amicus briefs. I'm sorry they didn't read both of them thoroughly. But hey, you know, you're one for two. That's not so bad.
I'll claim credit for the Google versus Gonzalez one. Sure.
Okay. Say two for three.
Okay, sure.
Two for three. Yeah. Okay. Kathy is, of course, an author at Tech Dirt. If you want to hire her, obviously specializes in IP law, CG Counsel, counsel.com, and on the Mastodon Cloud at Kathy Gellis. Great to see you. First time in studio.
Yes.
Thank you for coming up here.
Yes.
I hope you don't catch COVID. Is it my deep, fervent wish for you?
Oh, thank you.
Amanda, you're safe, I think, in your apartment in
the
beautiful Philadelphia. Yeah, softball, well, that could be dangerous. Amanda Silberling, senior culture writer, TechCrunch. First time on, so great to have you. We will have you back again soon. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, I'll continue to just make jokes about being younger than you and make everyone feel bad that's watching, which is what you want on the podcast.
You won't be the only one, believe me.
This will be me in, like, however many years. I'm going to be like, oh, God, like, your parents weren't alive for 9/11?
That's right. That's exactly right. Get ready. Mm-hmm. It happens sooner than you think. No, it's nice to have somebody under 30 on the show. I really think we need that perspective. I appreciate it, Amanda. It's great to see you. Harry, my buddy, my friend, the technologizer, find him on Fast Company. Every time he writes an article, it's something great, something fantastic.
Always.
No, I'm serious. You are no ChatGPT. You really find great topics. You know your history. And it's always, I mean, I read every one of them. Always.
I know it because I lived it, damn it.
You lived it. You were there.
I want to read this BlackBerry article now.
Yeah. I want to see the movie.
Me too.
I love the trailer.
You're watching Clue tonight, though.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Clue or maybe Succession, the penultimate episode. I envy you because someday you're going to get a DVD box set of all four seasons. And you're going to say, how did I not know this was the best show on television?
No, I mean, I've been I've been seeing people talking about it on Twitter relentlessly for years. And what's funny is actually before I worked at TechCrunch, I was like, I don't get it. Like, they're just in business meetings. And then now that I like know
now you understand. Yes.
I'm like, the stock price dropped below 120. And then they tried doing a hostile takeover.
And he offered 192 per share. What is he thinking?
It's a great show. I'm just very behind.
It's getting very exciting. Last week it was the presidential election, and it was a little too close to home.
That always hurts. I think we need more historical distance and certainty in our world before this will be comfortable.
Oh, it was very painful. Harry, Kathy, Amanda, thank you so much for being here. Thanks to all of you for being here. Thanks especially to our Club Twit members who make this show and all of our shows possible. If you're not yet a member, I want to invite you to join. $7 a month. You get so much. You get ad-free versions of all of our shows. Shows we don't put out in public, like Hands on Macintosh, Hands on Windows, Home Theater Geeks, the Untitled Linux Show. You get so much for your $7 a month. And I can't tell you how much that $7 means to us. Only about 1% of our audience has joined the club. I'd like to get that number up. Would you just check it out, please? twit.tv/clubtwit. We'd be very, very grateful to have you. And if you can't,
sure.
No problem. It's okay. What?
I'm sure you've made this joke, but it's cheaper than Twitter Blue.
It's a dollar less than Twitter Blue, and you get so much more. Actually,
you
I will send all three of you.
With value.
I will send all three of you a coupon because we'd like to have you in there on us. Because that's one of the things that makes Club Twit really fun. That Discord has a lot of our hosts in there talking as well. We do Twit every Sunday afternoon, right after Ask the Tech Guys, 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern Time, 2100 UTC. I say that only because if you want, you can watch us do it live. If you want the freshest possible version, it's at live.twit.tv. There's streaming audio and video. Plus, if you are watching live, you can chat with us live in our open-to-all IRC chat room, irc.twit.tv. Of course, Club Twit is also talking about it during the show. After the fact, ad-supported versions of the show available at our website, twit.tv/thisweekintech. By the way, when you get to that page, you'll see a link to the YouTube channel. There's a dedicated YouTube channel. You'll also see a link to various podcast players and the RSS feed. Best thing to do, subscribe in the podcast player of your choice, and that way you'll get it automatically the minute it's available. That's our IRC channel there, and this is the web page for This Week in Tech. Thank you, everybody, for being here. I'm going to go home and watch Succession. And I will see you. Remember, we are
Our schedule's changed a little bit this week. Tomorrow, Monday, iOS Today. What time, John?
9
a.m. So the same time, but they're going to move forward today because we are going to do live coverage of Microsoft's Build Developers Conference. We're going to cover, we think there's going to be important AI announcements and maybe some hardware announcements from Microsoft. So we are going to take a chance and cover both keynotes, 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 noon Eastern on Tuesday and Wednesday. I'll be joined by Richard Campbell on the first, Richard Campbell and Paul Theroux on the second. So I'll be back Tuesday bright and early, 9 a.m. for the Build keynote. Thanks, everybody, for being here. We'll see you next time. Another twit is in the can. Bye-bye. Bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.
Doing the twit.